Happy New Year, everybody. 2011 is in the books, and this is the first sound-off of 2012. It is Sunday, January 1st, here on SEScoops.com. I am the Solemn Monster. Hope everybody had a very good New Year's, a safe New Year's, wherever you are in the world. I know some of you in different time zones in other countries celebrated New Year's a little bit earlier than those of us here in the U.S. And wherever you are in the world, hopefully it was good to you, and 2012 will be good to you as well. And I can't believe it's actually been a year since I promised myself I would become a better person. I guess we're going to have to work on that for next year. This is a great year for the sound off here on SE Scoops. 2011 was a banner year for the show. We picked up a ton of new listeners. And I recorded a total of 59 shows last year, roughly 60 shows out of 52 weeks. That's not bad at all. And I had the opportunity to do some really cool interviews as well. I mean, getting to speak with George Napolitano for over an hour, a treasure in the business, was a highlight for me, as was speaking with the reigning Ring of Honor TV champion and former TNA X Division champion Jay Lethal. So we had a really great year, and I know 2012 will be another one as well. I enjoy doing the show now as much as I ever have before, and a lot of that has to do with you guys, your support, your feedback, both positive and negative. The fact that you keep coming back to listen is what keeps this show going. So let's hope for more of the same here in 2012. And this is going to be a big, big show here. I know a lot of people have been talking about episode 200, which, of course, is coming up next. 200 episodes almost here of the show. But do not discount 199 here. We have a lot to cover, including UFC 141 thoughts regarding Brock Lesnar, the former WWE champion, who perhaps will be coming home before long. Talk about Raw from Monday night as well, and my thoughts on the Kane promo, which seems to... a lot of people have a lot of different opinions on this promo. A lot of you guys I know liked it a lot. We'll talk about that. And I am going to do a year in review, 2011 of sorts. We're going to talk not just about WWE. We'll talk a little bit as well about TNA and ROH. And with WWE, we'll have a top 25 list of the most memorable things from 2011. So all that, and if we have time, maybe we'll do some mailbag questions at the end. But right now, right off the bat, let's talk about UFC. UFC 141, big pay-per-view on Friday night, not the typical Saturday night, so hopefully certain people didn't forget there was a UFC show. But they were against the idea of running on New Year's Eve, so that's why the show was on Friday. And it featured a very big main event, Brock Lesnar, former WWE champion and UFC World Heavyweight Champion, against Alistair Overeem, the former Strikeforce Heavyweight Champion, champion in K1, very successful mixed martial artist who, I believe this was his debut in the Octagon, his debut for UFC, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that, but I believe it was his debut. And a lot of people favoring Overeem in this fight. Brock, of course, has been out for many, many, many months. Brock Lesnar underwent some major surgery for diverticulitis, which is not a fun condition to have. And a lot of people speculating, you know, would Brock be the same? Would he look the same? Would he be able to fight the same? You know, he's known as a power wrestler, of course. Wrestling is his game. He's a former NCAA collegiate champion and all that. But Brock Lesnar came into this fight looking a hell of a lot better than a lot of other people would have, but not exactly looking, physically looking like the Brock Lesnar of old. And he went into the Octagon as the underdog. And striking proved to be the key in this fight. Overeem made it work for him, that's for sure. He hit Lesnar with some hard knees to the body. And Brock got off a couple of jabs in this fight, one of which apparently bloodied Overeem a little bit, but it was a futile effort on his part. The fight went a little over 2 minutes. It was over in the first round. Some may say it was over before it even began. Lesnar looked very tentative in there. And Overeem nailed a knee at one point during the fight that connected right with Brock's liver. I mean, right in that area where the diverticulitis had struck him. And that could not have felt good for him. The fight got stopped about 2 minutes and 26 seconds into the first round, and that was it. Overeem now gets a shot at the current UFC heavyweight champion, Junior Dos Santos. And Brock Lesnar, after the fight, officially announced his retirement from the Octagon. He said, quote, "I've had a difficult couple of years with my disease. I'm going to officially say that tonight is the last time you are going to see me in the Octagon." And he said that he had promised his wife, Sable, of course, former WWE diva, that if he lost, he would retire. And if he won, he'd go after the championship one more time and then retire after that. Which is an interesting thing for him to say, because the insinuation there is that if Brock had beaten Overeem in this fight, he would have gotten a title shot against Junior Dos Santos. And had he beaten Dos Santos for the championship, he would have then retired. And I don't know that you know, there was any sort of provision in his contract or, you know, anything like that that would have required him to continue fighting. If Brock wanted to call it quits after winning the championship back, he could have done that. I believe Brock has one more fight left on his contract, which Dana White is going to hold him to. Dana White can't force him to fight, of course, but Dana White can't hold him under contract. But it would have been very interesting because I guess in theory, if Brock had gone on to win the title and beaten Dos Santos and therefore fulfilled his contract and had no more fights and was free to go elsewhere, it sounds as though perhaps there was some sort of plan for Brock to then take the UFC title over to WWE. I'm not sure, you know, if there was a specific plan hatched by Vince McMahon and Brock Lesnar. It sounds like there may have been some sort of plan. And if I'm Dana White, I'm not very happy about that. You know, Dana and Vince McMahon have had a very cordial relationship. They are on speaking terms. They've had lunch. They had lunch recently, as a matter of fact. And publicly, no matter what WWE says, they realize that UFC is their strongest pay-per-view competition. UFC has been, you know, mopping the floor with them now for a couple of years. And UFC's pay-per-view business is nowhere near what it used to be. But it's still light years ahead of WWE. But still, Dana and Vince have maintained a nice little friendly relationship with each other. And I wonder, you know, what that means for that relationship now. I mean, to me, it was almost shocking that Brock would say that. At least, again, that's the insinuation, that perhaps he would have won the title and then he could have taken the title elsewhere. That might also make Dana White a little less likely to allow Brock to go do pro wrestling. You know, the big rumor, of course, after Lesnar announced his retirement that got the internet and Twitter and everything abuzz, is Brock Lesnar coming back to WWE? And, you know, Brock, of course, there was the tease of a potential match with The Undertaker. Undertaker was at a UFC show a while back, and Brock had lost his fight and was coming back through the crowd to go backstage. And there's Undertaker, and Undertaker made the comment, "You want to do it?" Obviously teasing some sort of match that never happened. Dana White said he would never allow Brock to do a WWF match while he was still, you know, a UFC fighter. And at the post-fight press conference, I mean, Dana White made it very clear that Brock Lesnar was retiring under contract. He would not be free and clear to go anywhere else without Dana's permission. And it's going to be interesting because, to me, it muddies the waters a bit. I would not expect to see Brock Lesnar in a WWE ring anytime soon. I do think at the end of the day that if Dana realizes Brock really is done, I think the reason that Dana might tighten the noose a little bit, he wants to make absolutely certain that Brock Lesnar does not go somewhere else in mixed martial arts, namely Bellator. Bellator is another promotion on the rise. They're going to be on Spike TV starting in 2013. And they are going to become the de facto number two promotion in this country when it comes to MMA. Dana does not want to give any ammunition to Bellator. And the last thing he would want to see is Brock Lesnar get a big money offer and decide to take it and go fight for them. So I don't think Dana is so much bothered by Brock going to WWE as much as he is Brock going elsewhere in the world of mixed martial arts. I think at the end of the day, if Vince McMahon wants to bring Brock in, and Brock wants to come in to do a match, because he's not coming back full-time, he's not even coming back part-time, Brock is not interested in that. He's not interested in going back on the road. It's just not going to happen. But I think if they wanted to do something with him at WrestleMania this year, for WrestleMania next year, SummerSlam, something big, Dana and Vince would be able to come to terms because they do have that relationship with one another. But it's again, I want to make it clear to people that who are saying, "Oh, Brock's coming in. It's a done deal. He's done with UFC. He can do whatever he wants." Not true. Not true. He needs the blessing of Dana White. Without that, Brock's not going anywhere because he is still technically under contract. As far as what Brock would do if you brought him in, obviously a money match would be Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker. Quite frankly, you know, if somehow they were able to get Brock in for WrestleMania 28, which I don't think they will be able to, but let's just say they were, I would not mind seeing Brock Lesnar and The Big Show reprising their old feud and having a match. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the Big Show, rather, and Shaquille O'Neal having a celebrity match. Shaquille O'Neal's a big wrestling fan. He kind of let it slip on a radio show recently that he was in discussions for a match with the Big Show. Let's just say if that thing falls through, I think Brock Lesnar and the Big Show would make for a hell of a match. You know, the two of them used to be very good friends. They may still be. Brock Lesnar brought the best out of the Big Show. I thought he and Big Show had some really good matches. My favorite match of theirs, in my opinion, their best match, was actually a stretcher match that they had at Judgment Day back in 2003. You know, but even their Survivor Series match at the Garden and other battles they had, I don't think Brock Lesnar, you know, at this stage of the game and you know, his age and everything would be able to throw the Big Show around quite as easily as he used to. I mean, he used to give Big Show belly-to-belly suplexes, belly-to-back suplexes, pick him up for an F5 like it was nothing. These tremendous feats of strength, I don't think Brock can necessarily do that again. But I'm just throwing that out there. I think that could be a hell of a match. I'm not going with Brock and The Undertaker because I just don't think it's possible. Triple H apparently has his WrestleMania match set with The Undertaker. Now, do I want to see Undertaker and Triple H Part 3? Of course not. I thought they had one of the greatest matches in the history of WrestleMania this past year. Not the greatest, but it was among the greatest, and it was certainly one of the matches of the year in 2011. Leave well enough alone. Undertaker beat Triple H fair and square. There was no controversy. There was no foot under the bottom rope. There was no shoulder up at the last minute, you know, that the referee missed or any sort of controversy. Undertaker made Triple H tap out in the middle of the ring. 10 years earlier at WrestleMania, Undertaker pinned Triple H. 1, 2, 3. There has been absolutely no controversy. Why we need to see Undertaker and Triple H for a third time when, again, the streak is not ending? There is no drama. Nobody believes that Triple H would beat The Undertaker. And people might say, well, come on, it's Triple H. He can play politics. He can get the match result changed. This is one situation where Triple H is not getting the outcome changed. He's going in there. I'm sure him and Undertaker can have another classic bout. Maybe not as good as the match they had this past year. They're both a year older. It was a miracle in many ways they even pulled the match out that they had. I guess the little wrinkle they're talking about adding is having Shawn Michaels as the guest referee. And Triple H puts his career on the line, so it becomes Streak vs. Career Part 2, this time featuring Triple H instead of HBK. It's an interesting story. You know, I guess that could work. There could be some drama. Whose side will Shawn Michaels take? His best friend's career hangs in the balance. You know, is he going to be fair and square and count the fall if Undertaker pins Triple H and end his best friend's career? Or will Shawn Michaels be partial because it is his best friend? And because, quite frankly, Shawn has bad blood in the past with The Undertaker. Will he screw The Undertaker and help end the streak? It's a good story. But I think it's time to put somebody else in there against The Undertaker. You know, I had suggested Randy Orton, which is apparently not going to happen. And Randy Orton did face The Undertaker once before, true. But that was many, many years ago. Undertaker, I mean, Randy Orton in many ways is a very different, very much more mature performer now than he was back then. I think that could be a great match. You know, Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, hell of a match. I think you can make some money off that. But no way is Triple H allowing his match with Undertaker, as it is set currently, to be stolen from him. By somebody who I'm sure in Triple H's view is some, you know, MMA guy who didn't give a crap and shat all over wrestling and, you know, they made him a star and he turned his back. I'm sure that's the attitude Triple H must have towards Brock Lesnar. No way he allows that to happen. So that's the Brock Lesnar story. I do believe we'll see him in a WWE ring at some point, maybe not until WrestleMania 2013. You know, Brock for a while now has been teasing a match with Steve Austin. I'm sure Austin would love that match too. I don't know how CM Punk would feel about that. I still think Punk and Austin would be a better match than Punk and, or rather, Austin Lesnar. But with Brock, you've got a couple of different options. You know, Brock is a very unique performer. I think he could work well with a lot of different people, and we'll see. We'll see in due time when he does come in and who he ends up in the ring with. But yes, Brock Lesnar's UFC career has officially ended, and as such, I'm going to give Brock Lesnar the sound-off salute for this week. Brock Lesnar is a guy who made it to the top of the pro wrestling world, multiple-time world champion, WrestleMania headliner, and decided, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go do something else. So he tried his hand at football, didn't quite work out too well for him, ended up in MMA, trained, and became successful in another sport, and became actually the biggest pay-per-view draw of the last several years. Brock Lesnar is a bona fide, or at least was, a bona fide pay-per-view draw. And Brock Lesnar had a nice short career for himself, and now it has come to an end, and hopefully whatever he does in the future, because again, he went through a life, potentially life-threatening, if not life-altering illness, which is not fun. And in many ways, it's a miracle that Brock was even able to get inside the octagon coming off the kind of surgery that he had. My hope is that Brock can live the rest of his life healthy and happy with his wife and his kids. and you know, have success in whatever he chooses to do. So I give Brock Lesnar the sound-off salute for this week. Let's talk about Raw from this past Monday night, the final Raw of 2011, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I thought this show was actually fine for what it was last Monday. You know, all roads lead to Memphis for the first Raw of 2012 this week, and the big January 2nd reveal. That's really what everything leads to. In a lot of ways, this was a lame duck type of show. Nothing to really sing home about. Lots of varied opinions, as I alluded to earlier, about the Kane promo to close the show, which I'll get to in a few minutes. Other than that, the big things on the show were the return of R-Truth from his 30-day vacation, attacking The Miz, and Dolph Ziggler winning a gauntlet match to get a title match against CM Punk next week. That's a match I am very much looking forward to. We also found out that Brodus Clay will once again not debut next week, and we will obviously find out who the mystery man is behind the 1-2-12 vignettes. So it's being booked as something of a loaded show this Monday night, something to look forward to there. Let's talk about the good. There was a bit of good on this show last week. I like the interaction at the start of the show between Johnny Ace and CM Punk. You know, laryngitis has become a guilty pleasure of mine on this show. He's so bad, he's good. And I always find myself waiting for his next gaffe. You know, this week it came in the first minute of the show. As he came down to the ring, he was doing a mock CM Punk entrance. He was wearing Punk's t-shirt over his own button-down and claimed, he was claiming to be Executive Vice President of Monday Night Raw. That's right. He was the Executive Vice President, not of WWE, but of Monday Night Raw. So great. As if this GM gimmick hasn't worn out its welcome over the last 10 years, now Raw has to have an Executive Vice President as well. So anyway, laryngitis said, you know, see, my entrance was exciting and unpredictable. He said this in the cheesiest possible way. It was great. You know, every anti-authority babyface versus corporate boss angle is going to be perceived as a ripoff of Austin versus McMahon, which it is. And none of them will ever come close to matching it. But I do enjoy the banter between these two, and I do look forward to an eventual match, which I believe is where this is going. You know, at least Johnny Ace is a former worker, so, you know, we might be surprised at what he can do inside the ring. I mean, maybe they'll do a match between the two of them for the title at the Royal Rumble. Just thinking about that, you know, I mean, it's not like anyone actually buys the Rumble pay-per-view for the title match, so why not? If you're going to do it on that show. I mean, if Chris Jericho does come back this week for a feud with CM Punk, I'd want to hold off on that first match between them until WrestleMania, so why not go with laryngitis in the meantime? We got the final vignette touting someone's return on this week's Raw. I've liked these promos. They're very well done, and they don't give too much away. It's created a buzz. You know, WWE's production team is very good at doing that when they put these videos together. They're very, very good. And, you know, this one said, this video on Monday said, a force will arrive to reclaim what is his, and that the end begins next Monday. And I'm sticking with Chris Jericho as my pick, with Undertaker as an outside shot. I'm starting to wonder if, you know, the end begins isn't some sort of veiled reference at the 20-0 streak, and this possibly being Undertaker's final match. I mean, it's possible, but I still think it's a bit early for him to be coming back. You know, could it be Skip Sheffield returning with his Ryback character, as some people have suggested, and, you know, maybe you save Jericho's return as a surprise for the Royal Rumble and have him win, like they did with Edge back in 2010. That's certainly possible. You know, but if Brodus Clay is really coming back on the show this week, to have him and Skip Sheffield, two quote, new guys, return on the same show with everybody expecting a big name, I could see where some people would see that as a bit anticlimactic. But you know what? I'm all for infusing new talent. I'd almost be okay with it. I don't think it's going to happen. It is fun to guess. You know, for what it's worth, Jason on our Facebook page a couple of days ago pointed out that Jericho has said he will be in Hawaii this Monday on January 2nd. So therefore, he can't be in Memphis for Raw. But Jason points out that Bret Hart once before claimed that he was going to be in Hawaii and then showed up on Raw that same day. CM Punk mentioned on Twitter the night he came back that he was going to be in Hawaii, and of course he wasn't. So now Jericho is saying the same thing. Just makes you wonder. I thought Booker T and Cody Rhodes had a good match, even though the crowd essentially crapped all over it. Boy, were these people quiet during this match. It was pretty long for a TV match. I think it went over 10 minutes or so, and Booker T won clean with an axe kick. So take notes, Alicia Fox. You don't have to decapitate your opponent while executing this maneuver. I guess because The Rock is back, Booker can't use his bookend anymore, which is too bad. I'm fine with him winning so long as Cody gets his due in the end. I saw some people, oh my God, you know, Booker T beat Cody Rhodes, you know, the young talent being buried. Shut up. Cody Rhodes, it's been the Cody Rhodes show for many weeks now on SmackDown. And he's getting the push of a lifetime right now. So one loss to Booker T, if they're going to keep this feud going, Booker has to win at some point. If it was just one match, you know, Cody won the pay-per-view match, Booker won this match. You know, it sounds like the rubber match is going to happen for the title on SmackDown next week. On SmackDown this week, Goldust was actually part of a segment involving these two, so perhaps we'll also be getting a match between the two brothers after all. That was an idea that Goldust had pitched to the creative team, and they were considering it. I don't know if it'll actually result in Goldust and Cody at WrestleMania. Quite frankly, I think that would be a huge step down for Cody, but, you know, it was an idea that was pitched, and apparently they're doing something with it, so there you go. Ricardo Rodriguez came out in a neck brace stemming from his ridiculous bump at TLC, and he wheeled Alberto Del Rio out in a gold-plated wheelchair stemming from the groin tear he suffered in the main event last week. He vowed to return as aggressive as ever, Del Rio did. The Bella Twins came out at one point during this segment and started arguing for no reason. The best part was Del Rio telling them to shut up and leave. Millions of married men across the country laughed uproariously. And, I mean, hell, it may have turned Del Rio babyface. So, he's out for a while. I thought the Gauntlet match was real good, too, for the time that Punk and Ziggler were in there anyway. It was a nice preview, I think, of what they can do if given some time on Raw this week. Punk never did make it to Mark Henry, who was going to be the third man in this gauntlet. Good for Henry, of course, being that he's still hurt. Johnny Ace ran down after Vicky Guerrero interfered, and in trying to be a fair party, Johnny Ace had her removed from ringside, but this provided enough of a distraction for Ziggler to hit the zigzag on Punk. He scored the pin, and a nice way to advance the Punk laryngitis feud again, if they're going to have a match ultimately, which I don't know if they are or not. I hope they do. This was a nice next step, I think, in the feud between the two of them. So that was the good on this show. Now let's get to the bad. There was a backstage promo on the show where Zack Ryder was thanking John Cena. And Cena told Ryder that he doesn't have to thank him and that Ryder wasn't handed anything. He earned the U.S. title on his own. Wasn't handed anything. Didn't John Cena give up a WWE Championship match so that Zack Ryder could have one more chance to win a U.S. title shot? Not only that, but Cena then interfered in that match and helped Ryder win. Did I just imagine that? Did that not really happen? What a stupid thing for him to say. Just completely stupid. Later in the show, the Reverend Billy Graham came out. John Cena came to the ring for another annoying promo. And I finally figured out what annoys me about his delivery. He thinks he's a preacher. You know, the arena is his church. And he's out there delivering a sermon. The only thing missing is the collection box, which I'm sure he can get that from the Deacon Batista if he asks him really nicely. But then again, Batista does blame Cena for all the PG bullshit, so he probably wouldn't give it to him anyway. So Cena comes out, and he says that he isn't Chicago's favorite son. He isn't America's favorite son. Why just Chicago? And he talks about the three WrestleManias that Chicago has hosted, and then he invokes the name of Eddie Guerrero to get himself some cheers. That is the only reason that Eddie's name was mentioned here, and I found it to be disgusting. I mean, I'm all for mentioning Eddie's name here and there to keep his memory alive. You know, when somebody does the Three Amigos suplexes, they mention Eddie, or there's an Eddie chant. I think that's great. But why mention his name in this promo, if not just to get himself some cheers? Is this the first time they've been back to Chicago since Eddie was inducted in 2006? Of course not. It's pathetic. So, this rubbed me the wrong way. Again, I know it was scripted for Cena to say, I'm not just blaming Cena, but I think it was just really fucking stupid. You know, they've been so goddamn desperate for weeks now to get people to cheer for John Cena. And I've talked about the legends that they'll parade out there, whether it's Mick Foley or if it's Roddy Piper, just practically on bended knee begging the fans to cheer for this man. And they have him out there mentioning Eddie Guerrero to try to get some cheers. And quite frankly, it didn't even really work. And I just thought it was pathetic. You know, don't mention the dead just to get yourself some fucking cheers. So he called out Kane because after being attacked for a second time, I guess he finally realized it was no accident and he should, you know, get mad at him. Miz came out instead, looking awfully orange. He talked about beating Cena in the main event of WrestleMania. He brought up how some people think because The Rock interfered, it was a fluke win, and he wanted to prove that it was anything but, so Cena said bring it on. They rang the bell for a match. Only there was no match, because Miz bailed almost immediately. And he grabs the microphone on the outside, and he's saying that he has nothing to prove since he's already beaten Cena before. Does WWE's wellness policy not check for bipolar disorder? 1 minute he's out to prove WrestleMania was no fluke, then the next minute he says he has nothing to prove. So this was when R-Truth made his return and absolutely beat the living shit out of The Miz. This part of the segment I actually enjoyed, even though this whole thing I'm putting in the bad category. It's been a while since we've seen a beatdown like this on TV, and any toughness that they've been trying to instill in The Miz went right out the window here. I mean, he didn't even fight back, I don't think, at any point. And Truth propped him up against the ring steps on the outside at one point and then cut a promo on him that when you open up your gifts on Christmas, the excitement ends. So he's going to take his time with The Miz and make Christmas every week. Crowd didn't seem to really care much for this, though, because Truth has been a heel now for months, and Miz is a heel. So they didn't know how to react. But I assume soon enough they'll come around. I think people will get behind R-Truth in a big way with this crazy character of his. Big Show beat David Otunga in a match where he had one arm tied behind his back. It was a match involving David Otunga. Of course, it's in the bad column. What else would you expect? He also desperately needs new music, Otunga does. Mark Henry came out for the DQ, went after Big Show, but Daniel Bryan came out for the distraction. Yes, the World Heavyweight Champion ran down to the ring to show off his shiny new belt and promptly ran away. He never even entered the ring. So Big Show grabbed Henry, but Otunga broke it up, and he was chokeslammed for his troubles. Not a very promising sign for Mr. Danielson here. And then Kane came out, end of the show, to cut a rambling promo as the main event, which is never a good idea, by the way, unless the promo you have planned is a home run. To put a promo as your main event, I would advise against that. After the way last week's main event bombed in the ratings, I can't say that I'm surprised they decided to put this here in this spot, but, you know. The key here was that Kane said, the world is a dark place and it's okay to hate. That was kind of the main message here. He said, humans are hateful by their very nature. Well, internet wrestling fans certainly are. So, rather than rising above the hate, he said, John Cena should embrace it. Because, you see, Cena was out on stage at this point. He was being kept at bay. There was a fiery explosion. Some magical powers were invoked by Kane, which I actually liked. That's kind of a throwback to the old Kane character. So he kept John Cena at bay on the stage to listen as he talked. So this was his advice for John Cena. Embrace the hate, he said. And I'm going to take Kane's advice here. I hated this segment. I know many of you liked it, and that's cool, but I didn't. You know, as much love as I have for the masked Kane character, his monologue here, I didn't think it was ever going to end. It just went on and on and on, and it got really boring by the end. You know, I went back to watch it a second time without overanalyzing it, and I took off my reviewer glasses, if you will, and I felt the exact same way. When Kane was world champion on SmackDown in 2010, they had him doing these same long, monotonous promos almost every single week. It was actually rather impressive how he was able to memorize all of it. The only difference between those promos and this one is that this one was missing the cheesy, overdramatic background music, which, thank God for that, because I always thought that sucked. I see what they were trying to accomplish with this segment, and I like the idea of Kane telling people it's okay to hate, because it makes sense with his character. But this whole thing just fell flat to me. I mean, Kane said the people chanting Cena sucks are really tearing Cena up inside. It just killed him inside, even though he always says it doesn't bother him. And he encouraged the people to chant Cena sucks, and well, let's just say it didn't work out exactly as they had planned. They showed some shots of the crowd, and all you saw were people with kind of blank expressions on their face. They weren't really reacting to anything. I mean, you could hear scattered chants in the background. Elsewhere in the building, they were mixed. You notice that when WWE tries to get the people to chant what they want them to chant instead of letting it be organic, that they fail more often than not. Yeah, the same thing happened during the last Piper's Pit segment when they planned that one moment where people were supposed to boo Cena, but they actually cheered for him instead, and it threw Piper off his game, which doesn't happen very often. Don't tell the people what to do. Just let them react. So they continue to tease a Cena heel turn here. That's basically what this was designed for. And I almost feel like if they wanted to turn Cena heel, it would be better not to telegraph it like this, and it would have had more impact if he just would have turned on someone unexpectedly one day. But it's kind of a moot point anyway, given that everyone already boos him. Here's the deal with Kane talking, okay? I need to defend myself here. I wanted to address this because I saw people on Facebook who were horribly misguided by my comment about how Kane just had to open his mouth and ruin everything. It was actually a joke I was making because, you know, people, you know, men say that about women. Chauvinistic men, anyway. I'm not one of them. It's not that I expected Kane to suddenly not be able to speak. I never said that. There's a big difference between having him say a few words, which probably would have had more impact. Remember, less is more. And having him come out and pretend to be a psychiatrist or a professor, like he's giving us a lecture in a giant study hall. And if Kane ever does become a college professor, by the way, I do hope he wears the mask and the fake hair for added effect. I mean, who wouldn't dare turn in their assignments on time? I mean, let's be honest. Personally, I would have kept Silent Kane going for a few more weeks and built up the suspense a bit more, but I'm fine with him talking. He's a good talker. I mean, hell, that's part of why he came back with the half mask instead of the full mask. That and the fact that he can breathe easier this way. You know? But this promo just wouldn't end. It got boring. It was stupid. His delivery here was completely goofy, by the way. I just didn't like it. I just did not like this segment at all. It was no good. And in the end, you were in one of two camps with this segment. You either really liked it, and you can't wait to see what happens next week, or you really hated it. I'm curious to see where it goes from here, but this, I hate it. I am embracing my hate. That's my opinion. If that bothers you, go get bent. As far as the ugly, there was no ugly on this show. It was some good, some bad, but that was pretty much it. So I just wanted to address the Kane stuff because I was amazed at, some people emailed me when they saw my comment on Facebook as though I had offended their family. You know, it's like I offended their soul by saying that I actually thought this segment sucked. And sometimes people cannot take criticism. It's like I'm criticizing their own work. Like, they actually scripted the segment for WWE. It was a bad segment. There's nothing wrong with that. They have good segments. They have bad segments. I like Kane. And you may think the segment was good. Hey, that's great. You know, more power to you. But I thought this segment was terrible. Couple of other news and notes here before we get to the year-in-review portion of this program. Alberto Del Rio is going to be undergoing groin surgery if he hasn't already. WWE announced on Monday that Del Rio's groin tear will require him to undergo minimally invasive surgery, and he'll be expected out for about 4 to 6 weeks. So as far as him being in the Royal Rumble, I would guess not, perhaps, but I think it would be very, very iffy. And Randy Orton also suffered an injury of his own that will keep him out for at least a couple of weeks. He suffered a back injury. This was a big story during the week that, as more details came out, kind of simmered down a little bit. There was a lot of fear and concern that Orton, and some unfounded rumors, as it turns out, that Orton would be out for as much as 6 months. He would miss the Rumble. He would miss WrestleMania. And that apparently is not the case. By the way, for those of you who didn't see it, Randy Orton and Wade Barrett had a Falls Count Anywhere in the Building match on SmackDown. That was pretty good. There was one really cool spot during the match where they brawl backstage. And I always love that. I love it when they have a match like this. Like, they used to have this all the time with those hardcore title matches where they would go in the back. And a lot of times with the hardcore title matches, they would go out of the building. I mean, one time Al Snow and Hardcore Holly wrestled into the Mississippi River, and I think it was at SummerSlam, maybe in 99, it was Al Snow and the Boss Man who brawled into the street, across the street to a pool, a billiards hall. But they went backstage, they brawled, and they brawled into an elevator at one point. A bunch of people came off, they went inside, the doors closed, and all of a sudden our camera view switched to the security camera, so we didn't have any sound, but we can actually see them in the elevator beating the hell out of each other. I thought this was great. This was so over the top, but this was great. I love stuff like that. That was a very creative thing for them to do. And, of course, at the end of the match, The story is that Barrett threw Orton down a flight of stairs. We didn't actually see Orton go down the flight of stairs. Of course, they would be pretty stupid, knowing he was really injured, to even attempt to have him go down the stairs. But when the camera guy came over, we saw Orton laying on his back in a heap at the bottom of the staircase. So they used it to get heat on Wade Barrett, I think, which is great. I have no problem with that. WWE.com had an update later in the week from one of their physicians who examined Orton. They said that he suffered a herniated disc on the L4, L5 level on the left side, and that has been resulting in some pain and weakness down his leg. He's going to need some time off for rehab, some medications, and some physical therapy. So the belief is that he'll be out a couple of weeks. He still may make it to the Royal Rumble. I don't know that he'll wrestle between now and then. If he really is that hurt, I think it would be dumb to have him wrestle. The plan apparently was for Orton to go over in the Royal Rumble in his hometown of St. Louis, which I cannot even fathom them putting somebody over in their hometown. I find that impossible to believe. But that supposedly that was the plan, and perhaps still is the plan. So we'll see what happens. Orton's been complaining about this injury now for about 2 weeks or so, and his workload has been somewhat lessened on TV these last 2 weeks. And that was the result, that was why the injury angle was shot on SmackDown. It was not that he got legitimately hurt on SmackDown, it was filmed that way because he was already in a great deal of pain. So, as I said, a lot of wild rumors during the week about the Orton story, which WWE themselves decided to play up for storyline purposes at their house shows. They actually announced that Orton would be out for 6 weeks. I think they just did that as a rib on all the people who were, you know, claiming that, which was bullshit. And a lot of rumors that perhaps Orton failed a third wellness test and that he was going to be fired. What really caught my attention wasn't even all of that. What caught my attention was the reaction of many of the Orton haters out there to the news that he had been injured and he might be out for a long time. There were several people openly celebrating the news because they think Orton is dull, they think he's boring, or they think he's been pushed too hard, he's held too many world titles, he's holding other people back, which of course is laughable, given the people that he's been putting over of late, especially Mark Henry. I've seen people say similar things about John Cena, you know, and wishing that he would die or he would suffer some major calamity so that at least it would freshen up the product and give his character a rest, as though that's their twisted way of rationalizing their point of view, their asinine point of view. Well, you see, if Orton gets hurt, or if Cena gets hurt, this is good for them, and it's good for the product. That's how they rationalize these things, these people. People like this are a poor reflection, not only of wrestling fans, but of the human race. To wish physical harm on someone playing a character on TV is about as ill-conceived as these morons one day breeding and spreading their stupidity. I mean, as much as I hate the Michael Cole character, for example, I know it's just a character. You know, I wouldn't actually wish death upon the man. I would be in favor of giving the Cole character the Paul Bearer treatment from the Great American Bash in 2004 and writing him out of TV by burying him in cement. I'd be in favor of that. But in all seriousness, again, I wouldn't wish death on Michael Cole. I wouldn't wish death on John Cena, even though I don't like his promos. I wouldn't wish death on Randy Orton. I actually kind of like Orton's work. I think he's had some great matches of late. So to see these idiots, these inbred idiots online talking about, well, this is great, yeah, he's injured, you know, and high five, you know, and they're celebrating. The world would be a much better place without people like this inhabiting it and breathing our oxygen. So it just struck me when I saw these people. That really is what caught my eye during the week. All of the inbred morons celebrating the fact that Randy Orton was hurt, possibly hurt so badly that he wouldn't be able to wrestle a match for 6 months. Give me a break. We have some more news on the WWE Network regarding pay-per-views. This comes courtesy of the Wrestling Observer. As of right now, the plan is for the Royal Rumble, Elimination Chamber, and WrestleMania to air on pay-per-view as usual, of course, since the network is not launching until at least April. For the rest of 2012, only SummerSlam and Survivor Series will air nationally as standalone pay-per-views. The rest of the shows will be WWE Network specials. Now, that being said, those shows are still probably going to be offered on pay-per-view, because most people won't yet have access to the network. But if you do have access to the network, you won't have to pay $44.95 to see them. Also, the Capital Punishment pay-per-view, We Hardly Knew Ye. It is being replaced by, wait for it, Bragging Rights. That's right, Bragging Rights, the uber-successful WWE pay-per-view concept that failed so horribly, they actually got rid of it. It's being brought back. It's being resurrected replacing the Capital Punishment pay-per-view. I guess because Capital Punishment doesn't sound PG? I don't know. Bragging rights, in theory, bragging rights could be something special, but it never is, because they never actually put anything on the line that means anything. They put a meaningless trophy on the line between two brands that aren't even distinct anymore. You know, now they have these Raw Super Shows and SmackDown Super Shows. You got Raw guys on Friday nights and SmackDown guys on Monday nights. So unless they completely blow up the concept and come up with something different and put something on the line, a draft pick, something, I don't really understand the point of bringing back bragging rights. But hey, at least by that point, if you have the WWE Network, it'll be a free special and you won't have to pay money to see it. And now it's time to look back on the year 2011. In professional wrestling, WWE, TNA, ROH. It was an interesting year, that's for sure. A lot of different things happening, some good, some bad. And the wrestling business continues to be mired in a bit of a rut. You know, they can't seem to really break free and regain a lot of that popularity they once had. A lot of old-time fans continue to flee professional wrestling. They're not impressed or happy with what they're seeing. For a brief moment in the summer of 2011, we actually had some of those old wrestling fans come back. WWE created a buzz. They were able to create an interesting angle, or at least they lucked out and kind of fell into an interesting angle that brought back some of those old fans. And I'm willing to bet that most, if not all, of those old fans who came back in July and August are probably gone by now. You know, WWE's goodwill was completely wasted. But you look back on 2011, you try to focus on the positives, and there were a lot of positives. There were a lot of great matches. There were a lot of new stars who came up. A lot of stars who maybe aren't so new, who were able to finally break through. And whether it was winning a championship for the first time, becoming a main eventer for the first time, who in their right mind would have ever thought that R-Truth would main event a singles match on pay-per-view? A lot of things happened in 2011. Really, 2011, in many ways, was a year of returns. It was the return of Big Daddy Cool Diesel and Booker T at the Royal Rumble. You know, TNA claimed they were coming, and they were coming all right, right over to WWE. It was the return of Triple H and The Undertaker. It was the return of The Rock. It was the return of Stone Cold Steve Austin as the new host of Tough Enough. It was the return of Mick Foley after a three-year stint with TNA Wrestling. It was the return of the classic Intercontinental title belt. It was the return of Lillian Garcia as the new ring announcer on SmackDown. It was the return of Kane with his old mask, wearing one for the first time since 2003. Hell, even the returns of Grandmaster Sexay and Bull Buchanan came in the year 2011. Who would have ever thought that? It was a coming of age for some wrestlers, guys like CM Punk and Zack Ryder and Daniel Bryan, The Miz, R-Truth, Cody Rhodes, Dolph Ziggler. And it was the end of an era for others, men like Edge and John Morrison. So as we reflect back on 2011 here, focus first on WWE. What I've done is compiled a list of the top 25 most memorable items from WWE in 2011. What does that mean? Well, it can mean anything. It could be a memorable angle that sucked. It could be a memorable angle that was great. It could be a new character. It could be anything. Top 25. And again, this is in no particular order. But we'll start from number 25 and work our way down the list here. Number 25. Jim Ross dancing and rapping and forgetting his lines instead of announcing. You know, if there was one segment from 2011, when it comes to good old JR, we saw JR a fair amount this year. They would bring him back, then they would take him back off the air, they brought him back, they took him off. If there was one segment that encapsulated everything that's wrong with WWE and everything that's wrong with Vince McMahon's portrayal, or not even his portrayal, his belief about what an announcer should be in modern-day pro wrestling, I'm sorry, sports entertainment, this segment was it. You have the greatest wrestling announcer of all time. Even people who don't like Jim Ross have to admit he's pretty friggin' good at his job. You have the greatest announcer of all time, under contract, sitting at home doing nothing but blogging and tweeting. And the best you could come up with for him to do is to put him on the show to embarrass him yet again, and you make him dance like a fool, and you make him rap. This is the best you could come up with for Jim Ross right here. That segment on that Slammy show was an abomination. but it was a great microcosm. It's a great representation of everything that is wrong with Vince McMahon's point of view about what wrestling and wrestling announcing should be in 2011. Number 24, Booker T claiming the only reason he walked out on Triple H as COO was because he had to use the bathroom. That's what he said. You'll recall the walkout, and Booker T was one of the people who walked out on Triple H back on Raw, and then on SmackDown when they asked him about that on commentary, he said, well, I had to use the bathroom. That's the only reason I walked out. I thought that was just amazing. Just an amazing line from a man who started the year as a pretty horrible announcer, and let's be honest, he's still pretty bad. He's gotten better in some ways, but that was one of the lines of 2011 right there from Booker T. Number 23, Shawn Michaels taking his rightful place in the WWE Hall of Fame. Obviously, you know, you make a short list of people who deserve to be in the Hall of Fame who aren't in there. And before he went in this past year, Shawn Michaels would have to be at the top of any list. I mean, yes, you could put Bruno Sammartino on there. Randy Savage obviously belongs on there. But Shawn Michaels is one of the all-time great in-ring performers ever in the history of wrestling in general, but especially WWE. I don't want to get into the business of comparing Shawn Michaels to some of the greatest that ever came out of Japan and all that, but Shawn is easily one of the greatest to ever lace up a pair of boots in WWE. He has consistently had great match after great match after great match, and is the only guy I can think of in WWE history to have two very distinct parts to his career, part one and part two, kind of like BC and AD in many ways. And you know, the early part of his career as a single star, he had some great matches. Then he got hurt. 4.5 years later, he came back and went on to have matches that exceeded even some of the greatest matches he had in his youthful years. Who would have ever thought that Shawn Michaels would go on to actually improve that way over time? You know, here we thought he was a broken shell of himself, literally with a broken back. And for him to come back and do what he did and accomplish the things that he accomplished and have the type of WrestleMania matches that he continued to have was pretty amazing. And we were all better for it. Quite frankly, we were spoiled by all of those great matches that Shawn Michaels went on to have. So I cannot think of a more deserving entry into the Hall of Fame than Shawn Michaels. We got to see that this year. He had a great speech as part of WrestleMania 27 weekend. Was not on the show. He was actually watching from the sidelines. And WrestleMania felt a little more barren this year without that one big marquee Shawn Michaels match. But again, if anybody deserved to take his rightful place in the Hall of Fame, you know, they've said about Ric Flair and guys like that, that, you know, those guys should have their own wing in the Hall of Fame. I think John Cena said the same thing about Steve Austin. Well, you can make the same argument about Shawn Michaels. There's been very few other competitors that have worked for Vince McMahon that have been as valuable to him. I mean, maybe men like Hulk Hogan and Steve Austin made Vince more money, and they meant more to Vince in terms of being a pay-per-view draw. But in terms of going out there and relying on somebody, especially when other people were hurt, and bringing Shawn back and expecting him to go out there and have a great match or bring a good match out of somebody else, you will not find a more valuable performer than Shawn Michaels. Number 22, I've kind of combined two angles here from the year, the dreadful Triple H COO storyline and Kevin Nash beating up CM Punk and texting himself. The COO storyline was really dumb, looking back at it. I suppose it had some potential, you know, Triple H coming out on Raw, announcing that Vince McMahon was hereby relieved of his authority. Never was Vince actually out of a position of power in the company. They never used the word fired. But essentially, Vince had been replaced, and Triple H was taking over as the top dog in WWE. And I think it went, 3 months? If that, maybe not even 3 months, before Triple H was ousted from power. They could not even keep the storyline going for, 6 more months. They had to just end it. And I can't say that it was the worst decision in the world to make, because the storyline sucked. And speaking of suck, Kevin Nash came back at SummerSlam and beat up CM Punk, who had beaten John Cena to retain the WWE Championship or win it back. I don't remember anymore. But this whole storyline about who texted Kevin Nash and told him to go and attack CM Punk, and was it Triple H, you know, his best friend, who of course had a beef with Punk? Did Triple H tell Nash, hey, go beat him up? And they were building this up for quite some time, and it was actually kind of an interesting storyline, and everyone was wondering, where are they going with it? It almost seemed too obvious to make it Triple H in the end. Well, apparently they felt the same way, And WWE decided to go with the absolute worst possible conclusion to this storyline. Because just randomly on Raw one day, Triple H comes out and he claims that he had security footage mailed to him by the arena 2 months later or whatever it was. And Kevin Nash comes down to the ring and admits, you know what? It was me. I went into your bag and from your phone, I texted myself. That was the end of the storyline. And by the way, Triple H beat CM Punk in a pay-per-view main event in 2011, and they never had a rematch. You know, at the time, there were a lot of people who said, well, let's see where this goes. And maybe I even said the same thing. I don't remember, you know, how upset I was or wasn't at the time. I know I raised concern about the fact that CM Punk was even having a match with Triple H and what the outcome might be. And, of course, Triple H beat him. Now, yes, it took outside interference, I think, from Miz and R-Truth, and I think Triple H needed three pedigrees to beat him. But still, the end result was Triple H pinned CM Punk in the main event on pay-per-view. And you say to yourself, well, perhaps they'll have a rematch and Punk will go over this time. But that never happened. In fact, Punk and Triple H were tag team partners, I think, on the very next pay-per-view show. So Triple H has his win over CM Punk, who at the time was the hottest commodity in wrestling, coming out of that angle over the summer. CM Punk was the man to a lot of people. And as I said earlier, he brought a lot of those old fans, those Attitude Era fans, back into the fold because they felt real change had come. Real change was coming to WWE. CM Punk was somebody they could get behind. He was this latest anti-authority figure that didn't care that people could actually cheer for. And he was the man. He was the number one guy. And Triple H, who had not wrestled since WrestleMania, he had not wrestled a single match since April of this year. And Triple H made his comeback match, a singles match against Punk, and he beat him. And Punk never got a win back. He never even had a chance to get a win back. It's just a match in the record books that's out there that proves that Triple H, in fact, is better than CM Punk, which I'm sure is exactly the way that he wanted that to go down. So now we can look back on this all these months later and realize that nothing ever really changes. It's always just about Triple H. I can't even imagine something like this happening, for example, with Austin, when he was first really taking off as a world champion back in 1998. I mean, it would be the equivalent of, at the time, if Hulk Hogan was still under contract or came back to WWF and just had a match with Austin on pay-per-view, just one match, and would have just beat him. Just pinned him in the middle of the ring, 1, 2, 3, and left. Can you imagine the deleterious effect that would have had on the career, potentially, on the career of Steve Austin if that would have happened? That's exactly what we saw here. Looking back, there was no earthly reason for Triple H to beat CM Punk and at least not have them come back for one more match, but that's exactly what happened. Number 21, Diesel returns at the Royal Rumble. Now, I have said some things about Kevin Nash in the past, and I actually tried to be very nice to Kevin Nash last week. Right here on the show, I talked about the fact that we may have seen him wrestle his last match. Apparently now Kevin Nash is telling people that he may be back. You know, he's hurt. He'll be back in a couple of weeks. I was of the impression that he was, you know, for now, officially retired. I guess we'll find out. But I ran down my top five favorite Kevin Nash matches. Not even, I can't say favorite, but like the best, in my opinion, top five Kevin Nash matches of all time. I went out of my way to compliment him last week because there are aspects to Nash that I like. And one of the things about Nash that I liked was the Diesel character. I like the Big Daddy Cool character, so to see the music hit and the reaction that he got when he came out as number 32 in the Royal Rumble this year was actually a really cool moment. And quite frankly, I don't think he ever matched that moment, you know, from his comeback at SummerSlam and that horrible angle he was involved in. Nothing quite matched that moment that he had in the Royal Rumble this year. I think WWE made a very big mistake by not bringing him back as Diesel. There's something about the character, instead of just calling him Kevin Nash, that just added something to it. It's like back in 2003, when Nash came back from his quad, I think it was from the quad tear, and he had that feud with Triple H. He was supposed to come back as Diesel, but what happened is, word leaked out on the internet, and so they were pissed off about that, and all plans at the last minute by Vince McMahon were aborted. So instead of him coming back as Diesel, he came back as Kevin Nash. We had our one Diesel moment in the Rumble this year, and I'll tell you right now, it was one of my favorite moments of the year. Say what you want to about Kevin Nash. There are moments like that that do kind of make you, they make it fun to be a wrestling fan sometimes, whether it's nostalgia, whatever you want to call it. I thought that Diesel coming back in the Royal Rumble was one of the good moments of 2011. One of the more enjoyable little surprises that we got from WWE this year. Number 20, WWE's Money in the Bank pay-per-view in July goes down as one of the company's all-time great shows. I said it at the time. I watched the pay-per-view and came out of it thinking, that was a really, really great show. And when you really stop and think about it, from top to bottom, not that every single thing about Money in the Bank was great, but for the most part, it was a fantastic show. And there are very few shows from top to bottom in WWE history that you can honestly say that about. WrestleMania 17 is one that people often wax eloquently about and they love. There was an In Your House pay-per-view, Canadian Stampede, back when the shows were only 2 hours. So it had that actually working to its advantage instead of being a three-hour show. Back in 97 that people say is one of the all-time great shows the company ever did. Well, Money in the Bank 2011 now has to be on that same list. The two Money in the Bank ladder matches on this show were phenomenal. Just great, great stuff. And one of my favorite moments from either one of those matches was the spot at the end of the Raw match where Rey Mysterio was climbing and Alberto Del Rio, in a fit of desperation, ripped the mask off Mysterio's face. That got a big pop. That was a very unique spot. And so to protect his face and protect his identity, instead of reaching up for the championship, Rey made a conscious decision to cover his face, got knocked off the ladder, and Del Rio ended up grabbing the briefcase. The other match, of course, saw Daniel Bryan go over as, in many respects, a shocking choice to win that match, especially when you consider how he was booked for the next 4 months, booked to be a loser. I don't think he won a match until maybe November, which is just ridiculous. But for one night, anyway, Daniel Bryan was the star. He was the man. He was Mr. Money in the Bank, and that was a really cool moment. It was a culmination for him of a lot of hard work, a lot of great matches over the years, and a validation, I think, of his work. We had Mark Henry in the Big Show with obviously the match that started their feud, the feud that won't end. But Big Show put Mark Henry over clean, like $1 million. I think it took I don't remember if he gave him two World's Strongest Slams. I think it might have been one and then maybe a big splash. But whatever it was, Mark Henry beat him clean and put the Big Show out by, I guess, breaking his ankle. And we have Randy Orton and Christian, who had yet another fantastic match. This one, Christian finally beat Randy Orton and won the championship. Granted, it was a very fluky kind of win, but the people went nuts for it. And it was a bit of a bipolar crowd in that the people were cheering Christian. They went nuts for him taking the title from Orton. And then when the match was over, Orton went crazy and attacked Christian and gave him an RKO, I think two RKOs, in fact, on the announce table. And the people were going nuts for Orton. It was ridiculous. And then you add, of course, CM Punk and John Cena, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But this was just everything pro wrestling is meant to be. The pieces fell into place perfectly. And the two of them had a fantastic, I think it was about 36 minutes. You don't see very many 30-plus minute matches in WWE anymore. This was something special right here. And, shockingly enough, WWE actually did something they ordinarily do not do. They did the right thing in the finish. The right guy went over. The way they handled this angle for this night was just perfection. Absolute perfection. And this pay-per-view was great. A lot of people think Money in the Bank should just be ditched as a pay-per-view concept and put back on the WrestleMania card. I'd actually be in favor of that, but I say that with some hesitation because we've had two Money in the Bank pay-per-views now in as many years, and both shows have been excellent. And this year's show, like I said, one of the greatest shows, I think, top to bottom the company has ever put on. Number 19, John Morrison plays Spider-Man at the Royal Rumble. This was one of the greatest spots in Rumble history, in my opinion. Now, you look back on this. This is when John Morrison was knocked off the apron by William Regal at one point during the 40-man Royal Rumble it was this year. And instead of hitting the floor and being eliminated, Morrison landed on the barricade, the ring barricade. And he landed in such a way that he looked like Spider-Man. Now, you look back on this, and you do ask the question, why couldn't he just hop down on the floor on one foot and hop back into the ring? After all, the rules of the Royal Rumble state that both feet must touch the floor. You know, that's how Shawn Michaels got away with winning in 1995. Yes, John Morrison could have, in fact, just hopped on one leg and easily crawled back into the ring. And instead, he just had a show off. He climbed up on the barricade. It's like he was stranded on an island or something like that. He didn't know what to do. He had, like, these fire-breathing dragons around him or something like that. And, you know, he didn't know which way to go. And he climbs up on top of the barricade. And it's like he's walking a tightrope. And he walks and he walks and he walks until he's parallel to the ring steps. And he turns around. And in one leap, he leaps off the barricade all the way over onto the ring steps. Just a perfect jump. And that was one of the coolest things I think I've ever seen in the Royal Rumble. You know, give the guy credit. You can say a lot of things about John Morrison, his, you know, his commitment or his attitude at times during the year, and I still think he's an absolutely terrible promo guy. But he's a great wrestler, and I mean, he can do physically, he can do so many amazing things. You know, his flexibility and the acrobatics and just all of that stuff. He's a very impressive guy to watch. But on this particular night, in my opinion, he was the star of the show with that spot in the Royal Rumble. Number 18, John Laurinaitis.
The Executive Vice President of Talent Relations and Interim Acting General Manager of Monday Night Raw.
That's my man right there. Let me tell you something. This guy has become a guilty pleasure. I said it at the beginning of the show, and I'll say it again. He is so bad, he's good. In a lot of ways, he's absolutely god-awful. I mean, as a person on the microphone, he makes constant gaffes. He's always stumbling over his own words. Sometimes it's even hard to understand what he's saying. Sometimes he'll talk way too fast. He doesn't wait for the right moment to pause and all that. So clearly, and even if you go back and watch some of the old Johnny Ace clips when he was a wrestler, even then he wasn't exactly a great promo guy. But it's become part of his charm in a lot of ways, and in a different way than Mike Adamly back in the day. Because Mike Adamly had absolutely no connection to wrestling whatsoever. He never wrestled. He was a completely unknown commodity being brought in from the outside. And from his very first night, he sucked. If you remember, he made his debut at the Royal Rumble in 2008 as a ringside announcer. And he called. He referred to Jeff Hardy, who was fighting for the championship that night, as Jeff Harvey. So talk about getting started on the wrong foot. John Laurinaitis, he's different in that, you know, it's become part of his gimmick now, which also happened with Adam Lee. Yes, that's true. But there's a certain charm that he has. So in other words, you know, when he says something really cheesy, he'll wink or he'll smirk or he'll smile in such a way. You just can't help but like the guy. And you can't help but want to see him get his ass kicked, which hopefully is where the CM Punk storyline is going. You know, if they could actually make some money off this and put the two of them in a pay-per-view match where people want to pay money to see CM Punk kick the shit out of this guy, I say all the power to him. You know, that's great. That's what it's all about right there. So Laurinaitis has become a guilty pleasure of mine. You know, I don't want to see him all over the shows all the time, but whenever they pan away from one of his backstage segments and he starts, you know, feverishly texting on his cell phone, I just think that's great. And he was a complete surprise. He came out of left field. Nobody expected him to become an on-air television character. He was so bad at first that Vince McMahon decreed that he was no longer to be given any speaking roles on the show. He would make appearances but not speak. And after a couple of weeks, that went out the window because they realized as involved as he was going to be, he had to talk. And it's become actually one of the best parts of Raw each week. I don't know what that says about the quality of Raw on most weeks. But Laurinaitis is somebody who I could certainly get behind. And he was one of the more enjoyable aspects to Raw over the last couple of months in 2011, as far as I'm concerned. Number 17 was the payoff to the anonymous Raw general manager storyline. But what's that? Oh, there was no payoff. Oh, I see. Well, then I guess we'll just move along to number 16 on the list, which is Kane's return, Masked Kane. After all these years, 2003 was the last time we saw Kane wearing a mask on Raw. And out he came a couple of weeks ago to attack John Cena, wearing not one but two masks, as a matter of fact. And he rips one mask off, revealing the old half mask. And I don't know about you guys, but there's something about Masked Kane that takes me back to a time that was even more fun than it is now, quite frankly, to be a wrestling fan. And it took me back to a time when Kane used to be quite the intimidating character. I don't know that they'll ever be as intimidating a character as the original Kane character with that original mask, but it definitely adds a certain dimension to him that's been missing for a while. And at the end of the day, who doesn't love masks? I mean, for God's sakes, Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers wore masks. If they could wear masks, Kane can wear a mask. Masks are cool. I say in 2012, we need more masks in wrestling. Number 15, anal bleeding. I don't really have anything else to say about that, but that had to be on the list, and so there you go. Number 14 was the return of Tough Enough with Stone Cold Steve Austin as the host. I was very excited to hear about the return of Tough Enough, and I think for the most part it lived up to expectations. I very much enjoyed this latest season. It was you know, a little bit different from previous seasons. Obviously, the biggest difference being that Al Snow was not the head trainer. He was not connected to it in any way. And Austin, I thought, in his role was great. His role was fairly limited. It wasn't like he was in there rolling around with the guys every day, although he did get in there and have matches with some guys. But obviously, Tough Enough was built around the final 5 minutes of every show. And Stone Cold getting two people or three people in the ring, I think it was three people, in the ring together to tease who was going to be eliminated that week. And in other cases, Austin got very animated, as only Austin can, to try to talk some sense into some people and wake them up. And there were some very entertaining moments on the show, and there were some standout performers as well. Martin Cassius, of course, was somebody who, to me, didn't look like much at first, and he developed into one of the best people on the show. Unfortunately, he got hurt. Otherwise, I think he had a legit chance of winning the whole thing. And it's kind of weird that you look at a guy like Martin, and you look at a guy like Luke Robinson, who came off as completely unlikable, but obviously he had certain talents. You know, he was a pretty good wrestler for his level. He was a good promo guy. He understood what it took to get people to hate you and that that could mean money. And the fact they had some talented people like that on the show. But in the end, they went with Big Andy. When was the last time you heard about Big Andy? It's been a while, hasn't it? There's a reason for that. They signed Ariane to a contract, who, if I remember correctly, was the first girl eliminated on the show, and she was the one who responded that her favorite match of all time, when she was put on the spot and had to tell Stone Cold what her favorite match, men or women, of all time was. Her choice was Melina against Alicia Fox. If that's not enough to earn you a lifetime ban from professional wrestling, then I don't know what is. But I believe they've signed her to a contract. Ivelisse, who was another woman on the show, who was okay, she wasn't great or anything, they signed her to a contract. Yet again, WWE not having their priorities in check. We need more new faces in the business, and there's a lot of guys right now down in FCW who I'm dying to see on the main roster. They've got some real talent down there. But why Big Andy got a shot, and he's floundering in Florida when somebody like Luke hasn't even been given a second look by the company? It's just mind-boggling to me. To say that the guy had nothing, and so therefore we're not even going to... I mean, it's not like guys who got eliminated from the show were not given the opportunity to come back. Like I said, Ariane, Ivelisse, they brought people back, runners-up. You know, some of the biggest divas, I think Eve Torres came from the Diva Search, and not necessarily all these people won, but they saw something in them, and they decided to offer them a contract anyway. The fact that, you know, you have talented guys like Luke and Martin, who apparently... it never even got a second look by the company. It's just incredible to me. That's one of the great stories told by Tough Enough, you know, which isn't necessarily a good story to tell. But as for the show itself, I enjoyed it, and I'm disappointed they haven't decided to bring it back yet. My guess is Tough Enough will come back with Stone Cold as the host, but it'll be a show for the WWE Network. And not the USA Network, which, if that's the case, it makes sense. But unfortunately, you and I, and probably most people listening to the show, will not have access to the new Tough Enough on the new network if, in fact, it gets green light for a second season. It's not dead yet. Supposedly, there's still some decisions being made about whether or not it's coming back. If I had to take a guess, I would guess that Tough Enough does come back, and it comes back on the new network because the ratings on USA just were not strong enough. But I very much enjoyed the rebirth of Tough Enough, and I support Stone Cold Steve Austin as the host because he's entertaining as hell. You can tell that he has a passion for it. He really wants to see these kids succeed, and Steve Austin just has a very entertaining, very colorful personality to begin with. So Tough Enough was one of the more enjoyable aspects to WWE television in 2011. Number 13, let us not forget the coal mine. I could say a lot of things about Michael Cole. In fact, I will in just a second. But I thought the coal mine, at least at first, was kind of a creative, clever little gimmick, even though it wore out its welcome over time. And it was kind of pointless, as easy as it was for somebody to get into that goddamn thing if they really wanted to. But one of the best moments of 2011 involved the coal mine. It involved the coal mine on Raw when Jim Ross shook it. If you remember, Jim Ross was brought into this whole storyline with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, and there was that one episode of Raw where Jim Ross is outside the coal mine, and he begins shaking the coal mine violently. He begins shaking it like the Ultimate Warrior would shake the ring ropes. And I just thought the image of Jim Ross standing there violently shaking this thing while Michael Cole, hollers and hoots on the inside is actually quite hilarious looking back at it. So that makes my list at number 13. Number 12... 2-21-11. We all know what that meant. It meant the arrival of Sting in WWE. Well, actually, not true. Sting did not come to WWE. It was actually the return of Undertaker and Triple H. Triple H had been off television for almost a year. Undertaker had been gone for a while as well. This was to build up their WrestleMania confrontation. But my God, if the internet didn't let its mind run wild with thoughts of Sting coming to WWE for a feud with The Undertaker, which actually I still think would have been worth something. It would have been money. It would have been cool. It would have been different. It's one of those few dream matches between these two old-school characters that we still have left, Sting and The Undertaker, these two dark characters that have never, ever crossed paths. The timing was such that Sting's contract had expired with TNA, and it got people thinking, hey, you know, this promo, this guy in a long trench coat, this could be Sting. I think I see some of the face paint. People, when people want to see something, they will see it. And this was a prime example of that. The promos were an edict from Vince McMahon to the production team to put something together because The Undertaker was coming back. And as it turned out, people thought it was not The Undertaker. They thought that it was Sting. And a sign that he was coming over to WWE, he was available. They snatched him up. They were going to bring him in for a WrestleMania match. And a lot of people were very, very disappointed when that did not happen. And it was, in fact, The Undertaker and Triple H. And we will look back on 2/21/11 as one of the, I think probably will go down as the one WWE promo video that they put together. And they put together a lot of these things over the years. But this one here created more buzz than I've ever seen before. Ever. It was amazing. Even, you know, I was guilty of the same thing, throwing out thoughts about who it might be. Could it be Sting? Is it Sting? I remember there was a blurb here in my local newspaper in New York, the Daily News. They have somebody who writes for them called the Slammer, who doesn't show his face. And there's good reason why he doesn't show his face, because he's wrong most of the time. And in this case, he actually had a printed item in the newspaper that announced that Sting had signed a one-year contract with WWE. And I would love to see this contract in print, by the way, because Sting is actually competing for TNA. So I'd like to know how that works if Sting is under contract with WWE. It wasn't Sting, and if you know what? That was the opportunity right there for it. And if Sting didn't come in last year, and he's obviously not coming in this year, he ain't coming in at all, because he's not getting any younger either. He's about 53 years old. Going on 54. But it was fun to guess, and it was fun to speculate on who it might be. But in the end, there were a lot of very disappointed people. Number 11 on the list I have as Triple H's takeover of Developmental. This is a story I think that's going to play out more so in 2012 and the years to come. But this was the year that Triple H was officially put in charge of the developmental division of WWE. They gave him credit for the Sin Cara signing, which, of course, was bullshit. He did not sign Sin Cara. They gave him credit for the Karma signing, which I think they were going to sign her anyway. We still have yet to see somebody that Triple H himself has actually recruited or signed, but he's got some ideas about how he wants to run things. I mentioned this about a week or two back on the show that, you know, he has this philosophy, which I support, where you don't bring somebody up from Florida unless you know that you're ready to put them on television. In other words, you don't bring them up to be on TV for 3 weeks and then bring them back down. You only have one chance to make a good first impression. That's with anything in life, and wrestling is no different. How many guys have been put on television, and within a matter of weeks, they have been yanked and sent back down to developmental, or cut outright, their career ruined, finished, because they had one chance and WWE fucked it up. Or maybe they fucked it up themselves, but they were too green. They shouldn't have been on TV in the first place. Jackson Andrews, the bodyguard for Tyson Kidd, is a great example of this. Mason Ryan, another great example. And notice he's disappeared from television recently as well, because even they couldn't save this guy. Even they knew he was so jacked up and immobile, they could not do shit with Mason Ryan. So you don't see him on Raw every week anymore. So the point is, Triple H has this philosophy where people, we need to have an idea when we bring somebody new in. We're not just going to put them on TV and not have a long-term plan for this person. So the hope is that when people like Seth Rollins, when people like Dean Ambrose do make it to the main roster, it will be because they have a character, they have a vision, they have a direction for these people. And you know what? They may still fail. I mean, Ambrose and Rollins, I think they're going to be a success no matter what. It's kind of like the CM Punk thing, the Daniel Bryan thing. Even if they get beaten at first, even if it takes a couple of years, those two guys have a shitload of talent. And ultimately, the talent rises to the top. I'm not really worried about them, but there's a lot of other guys down in developmental right now who should be worried. But if Triple H has his way, I think it's a good philosophy to have. This could have a very positive impact on the company going forward. They need new stars. You know, 5 years from now, I would love to know who the top five or six stars in the company are going to be. And I'm sure John Cena and Randy Orton are going to be two of them. And CM Punk will probably be three. But what about the other guys? You know, who are they going to be? Nobody knows. But a lot of that has to do with Triple H's handling of developmental. And 2011 will go down as the year that he officially took over and put his new plans into effect. We'll see if it bears any fruit in 2012. That's going to be one of the big, big stories to watch going forward. That's why I put this on the list here. It may seem kind of out of place on this list, but this right here is an important story. I don't think that gets as much play as it deserves. This is going to have a very big impact on the future of this company, and I think of the wrestling business in general is going to have a lot to do with how they handle their developmental system. Number 10 on the list, guys like Mark Henry and Christian and Daniel Bryan and R-Truth finally getting a chance to shine. And I use that term loosely with Daniel Bryan. I put him on the list because he did win Money in the Bank, which he didn't have to do. They did put the World Heavyweight Championship on him, even if it was a last-minute decision. And who knows, they may take it off him in a couple of weeks. But Bryan, Truth, Christian, Henry, these are guys that ordinarily you wouldn't expect to be a champion or you wouldn't expect to be in a main event position. And each one of these guys had an opportunity to do just that in 2011. Mark Henry became only the third African-American World Heavyweight Champion in history behind Ron Simmons and Booker T. If you don't count The Rock, of course, who's part Samoan. That's a pretty impressive statistic right there that I don't think they played up enough, if they even played it up at all. I don't even think they played it up at all. You know, for a company that never used to be shy, and even today, is not shy about playing up racial stereotypes and, you know, being jingoistic and xenophobic and all these different things, I'm surprised. For PR purposes, they didn't play that up. But Mark Henry is one of the real success stories of 2011. You know, here's a guy who was under contract with the company for 15 years. They signed him to a mega, mega contract, $1 million deal in 1996. Former Olympian. They had big plans for Mark Henry. And Henry just never met their expectations. He was the world's highest paid job guy. Not that he was jobbing all the time, but in a lot of ways, he was the highest paying job guy in the history of wrestling. Then he went through this stretch where they tried to push him as a monster, as they do with so many other guys, these start and stop pushes. Then he started getting hurt all the time. He hurt his leg, he hurt his knee. Just bad, bad string of luck for Mark Henry. And there were times when they tried to get him to quit the company. That's one of the reasons that Mark Henry had that storyline back in the late 90s with Mae Young. They were trying to get Henry to quit the company so they could get out of having to pay him on that big contract. So let's take this big guy, this former Olympian, world's strongest man, whatever shred of pride and dignity he may have left, let's put him in a storyline where he's attracted to a 75-year-old woman, where she gives birth to a hand. But Mark Henry was unflappable. He wouldn't let it get to him. And he stuck it out. And in the end, all these years later, it took 15 years, but he's a world heavyweight champion. Now a former world heavyweight champion, but he won the big one. And Randy Orton, I give Randy Orton a lot of credit. He could have put a big fit up. He could have put a shit fit up about putting Mark Henry over. Randy Orton used to say that one of his least favorite opponents to be in the ring with was Mark Henry. He did not like working with him, but he worked with him here, and he put him over at the pay-per-view in September. He put him over at Hell in a Cell again. They didn't beat Mark Henry up until recently. They hadn't beaten Mark Henry since May or June of this past year. That was the last time Mark Henry got pinned on television. Isn't that amazing how that works? When you take a guy and you don't beat him all the time, how he just happens to get over? Isn't it funny how that works? That's a funny thing, isn't it? Well, guess what? We don't see enough of that on television. We need to see more of that. Not that everybody can go undefeated, but if you have a guy that you want to push, and God knows you need more stars. When guys like Rey Mysterio go down hurt, Randy Orton goes down hurt, Sin Cara goes down hurt, Undertaker wrestles once a year, Big Show is just off TV for 3 months, Kane was off TV for 4 months. What happens tomorrow if John Cena gets hurt? What are you going to do? If they actually could build people up the way they built up Mark Henry, they may actually have more stars in their roster who can move the ratings needle, who can make the money. Why do you think SmackDown's ratings have been soaring over the last couple of months? Is it because of Mark Henry? There's no way to prove that necessarily. I guess you could break down the quarter hours and try to figure it out. But my guess is that Mark Henry had a lot to do with that. And who in their wildest dreams would have ever thought that Mark Henry would make a difference in the ratings? But he did. And if he hadn't gotten hurt recently, I think he'd still be the World Heavyweight Champion in 2012. That's an amazing story right there. Christian is another story. Now, he was the beneficiary, unfortunately, of his best friend getting hurt and having to retire. But Christian, for the first time in his career in the WWE, became a World Heavyweight Champion. And even though titles don't mean shit these days, it still means something, especially to these guys. So for Christian to be the World Heavyweight Champion, and remember, Vince McMahon once told Christian to his face, "I don't see you as a main event guy." But shit happens. People get hurt. People get desperate. You want to try new things. And they decided to put the title on Christian. So now he's a former two-time World Heavyweight Champion. Daniel Bryan, I talked about. R-Truth, not yet a World Heavyweight Champion, may never be. But here's a guy who, again, was a jabroni in WWE for years. I mean, the lowest of the lows for this guy was when that episode of Raw, and I don't remember if it was in 2011 or 2010, it might have been 2011, where he was in a city, and he did his little entrance, and he mentioned the city name, but it was the wrong city. He got reamed out for that backstage. It was embarrassing. I thought that was it for him at that point. But he somehow managed to keep his job and stay on TV. And then came the heel turn, when he turned heel on John Morrison, and he beat him up, and he smoked the cigarette, and he started to go a little bit, well, batshit crazy. And that's all it took. That was it. He turned heel, he went nuts, he embraced the character, he ran with it, and he got himself over. And he got a pay-per-view main event with John Cena out of it. I look back on 2011, among other things, this is one of the top stories to me. Guys like Mark Henry and Christian and Truth, who you probably would have written off years ago, and probably should have been written off just based on the way they were booked, finally getting a shot to shine and taking advantage of it. Number 9 on the list, Jerry Lawler's big year. Jerry the King Lawler has been with WWE in some capacity from 1993 until the present day, with the exception of that year in 2001 that he quit at a protest when his wife, the Cat, Stacy Carter, got fired. He was MIA from WWE from about February until November of that year. But aside from that, it's been a hell of a run for the King in WWE, especially when you look back in the early 90s, and Lawler was always a vocal critic of Vince McMahon and WWE destroying the business, and he used to say just horrible things about them. And then just one day on WWE television in late 92, there he is, popping up on their TV show. And, you know, his promotion in Memphis then had a working relationship with Vince and all that. It's funny how that works. But anyway, Lawler had perhaps his best year ever in terms of his WWE career. He got to wrestle on 4 straight pay-per-view shows, including his first ever match at WrestleMania, which has legitimately meant something to him for a long time. He has always wanted to have that one match to say that he competed at a WrestleMania. And he's always gone to Vince McMahon to remind him about it and to ask him about it. And Vince would always be, "Oh my God, you've never had a match at WrestleMania? I can't believe this. We'll have to do something about that." And nothing ever happened. Not because I think Vince was intentionally trying to fuck, you know, Lawler over, but just he would forget, you know, Lawler wasn't exactly a priority to Vince McMahon. And Lawler finally got his big match. And he got a match with Michael Cole that he won, and then the outcome got changed. So technically he lost. But it was still a feature match on the WrestleMania show this year. It was an absolutely terrible match because of the way it was booked. That match never should have been booked to be a real match where Lawler was on the defense most of the time. I don't know who. Apparently Dean Malenko was the brainchild who helped book that match, and he got in a lot of hot water for it after the fact. And it's surprising that Malenko would have been the one in charge of that, and that's what we ended up getting. But nonetheless, Lawler got his big WrestleMania match. He got a match on the pay-per-view in February, as a matter of fact, a WWE Championship match with The Miz. And at least at one point, they had considered putting the title on him, briefly. You know, Lawler had a match as well in, I believe, the tag match with JR against Swagger and Cole came in April. There was another pay-per-view match in May. So we got a couple of pay-per-view payoffs out of it. The title match against The Miz, by the way, at the Elimination Chamber show came on the heels of Lawler's mom dying. And so that kind of played into the storyline. It was a very, it was an emotional angle, actually. You know, the fact that, yes, they were playing off the fact that Lawler's mother died, but I'm almost convinced it was probably Lawler's idea. So in that respect, I'm okay with it. And it did add a lot of emotion, a lot of kind of drama to that match. And I don't know that that match was as good as the TLC match that Lawler had on Raw with Miz in 2010, which was a nice hidden gem, quite frankly. That was actually a hell of a match on its own. And for a guy like Lawler at 61 years of age to go out there and still be able to perform the way that he does is very impressive. But Lawler had a banner year in WWE. After all these years of working for the company, this was his most notable year with them. And quite frankly, I don't think he should be in any more pay-per-view matches. I think, when the situation presents itself, clearly Lawler can do this better than a lot of guys on the active roster can do it, because he's an old-school guy who knows how to work. But, big year for Jerry Lawler. Number 8 on the list, Dolph Ziggler and his match with Edge at the Royal Rumble. Not that the match itself was any great shakes. It was a really good match. But I mentioned the match with Edge at the Royal Rumble because if you go back and listen to the sound-off, maybe even several sound-offs leading into the Royal Rumble, if I remember correctly, I was talking about the fact that that match that Ziggler had with Edge at the Rumble was going to be a very, very important match. And everything would have to go right if Ziggler wanted to have any hope of getting a push in the future. And I became a Ziggler fan. I'm still not a fan of his name. But I became a Ziggler fan as him as a worker. He's gotten a lot better over time, to the point where he's one of the best workers, in my opinion, on the roster right now. You know, he could take bumps like the best of them. He can actually wrestle a pretty good match. He used to be a collegiate wrestler. But it's that evolution of Dolph Ziggler from the beginning of the year to now that I think is most striking, because he really has become one of the most valuable players on the roster. But it goes back to that match with Edge at the Royal Rumble, because if he would have had a bad performance in that match, if he would have blown spots left and right or gotten hurt or something, had the crowd crapped all over the match, I don't think that Dolph Ziggler would be in the position he's in right now. In fact, I don't even know that Dolph Ziggler would be employed by WWE right now. As fickle as they can be, they may have cut him back in August when they had their bloodletting and they cut rid of a bunch of other people. They cut Chris Masters, they cut Melina, they cut Harry Smith. You know, maybe Dolph Ziggler would have been on the list back then. I really think that match with Edge at the Royal Rumble was a lot more important than people remember it being. A bad performance in that match could have been just disastrous for his career, but he had a great performance in that match. And he went on to have great match after great match. People realized, okay, it wasn't that Edge carried him to a good match. He's just a pretty good worker. And they put the U.S. title on him, and he just got out of the feud recently with Zack Ryder, and now he's getting a championship match. The first Raw of 2012 is Dolph Ziggler challenging CM Punk for the WWE title. So you look at his evolution from the beginning of 2010, or rather I should say the beginning of 2011, to the beginning of 2012, and he's going from one championship match to the other. Not that I expect him to win this Monday, but that's not the point. The point is, the evolution of Dolph Ziggler is happening before our very eyes. This guy's going to be a big star sooner rather than later, but it all goes back to that Royal Rumble match with Edge. One bad performance there, and it would have been curtains for his WWE career. As it turned out, he took advantage of it, he embraced it, and now he's one of the biggest young stars on the roster. And to that I say, thumbs up. I'm a Dolph Ziggler fan. I want to see him go far. That Royal Rumble match played a very big role in the success that he had in 2011. Number 7 on the list, the Randy Orton-Christian feud. One of the most lopsided feuds you'll ever see in WWE history, especially for a main event level feud. Christian just almost didn't win any matches at all. I mean, he finally won a match at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, which was more of a fluky win than anything else. I don't know, tag matches aside, I don't know that he ever won another match against Orton. I can't remember him beating Orton in any match other than that one. Orton just kept beating him and beating him and beating him, and obviously, Orton beating Christian on SmackDown that first time in May to become the World Heavyweight Champion just 4 days or 5 days after Christian won the title on pay-per-view. Technically, it was 2 days, but since SmackDown airs on Friday nights, it was 5 days. Boy, did that make people very angry. That got a lot of people very upset, myself included. And, you know, the thing about it is that it was part of a long-term plan, but, you know, would I have booked Christian that way? Of course not. I would have booked this feud to be more even-handed, because it would have helped the feud out. It got to a point where it was almost comical that, you know, why would people expect Christian to be competitive to Randy Orton when he never wins a match? But the funny thing about it is that every single match they had was great. I mean, you can't really say that Randy Orton and Christian ever had a bad match. Some matches were better than others. You may have a favorite match that, for whatever reason, you like better than all their other ones. But not one time did Randy Orton and Christian step in the ring to go one-on-one in 2011 and have a bad match. They always had very good to great matches. You can't beat that. That's what wrestling's all about. You want to see two guys go in there and beat the hell out of each other and have a match. And when the match is over, you're like, God damn, that was a great match. And the thing about Orton and Christian is, no matter how foolish it was to book Christian that way, they always had a good match. I always look forward to seeing them wrestle. And even after they had their, you know, 18th match of the year or whatever the hell it was, yes, it was already growing a little bit tired. I was just at that point where I was ready to see them move on finally to other opponents. But I never got that tired of seeing them in the ring together. I thought I would get a lot sicker, like John Cena and The Miz. You know, after their second or third match, I did not need to see another John Cena versus Miz main event. I never had that same feeling with Orton and Christian, because those two guys had a chemistry that you can't manufacture. Some guys have it, some guys don't. And whenever you put those two guys in the ring together, it was like magic. I mean, I loved their matches. And so the Randy Orton-Christian feud, as lopsided and ridiculous as it was in many respects, is one of my favorite things to look back on in 2011. Number six on the list, Twitter. And trending on Twitter. Get used to it, folks, because it's only going to get worse in 2012. It's not going away anytime soon. 2011 is the year that WWE finally embraced Twitter. They wanted to take a proactive approach to social media instead of shunning it. They decided, we're going to go all in with this Twitter thing. And apparently they have some sort of deal where they actually make money. I don't know how they're monetizing it, but supposedly they are. But the reality is that this Twitter crap has just got to be toned down. I have no problem with WWE being on Twitter. I have no problem with them putting little boxes in the corner of the screen, as ridiculously stupid as they may be. And the reason it's ridiculously stupid, okay, I'll be honest with you here. I keep calling it stupid. It's stupid because WWE's concept of what trending means is wrong. It is factually incorrect. Their belief, or maybe not even their belief, maybe they know it's bullshit, but the way they portray it on television is that when you trend on Twitter, you are the most talked about, most popular person or thing or pay-per-view title or whatever it is in the world at that moment. That is wrong. That is not what trending on Twitter is all about. But that's how they portray it on television. And it's just absolutely infuriating. At least if they were telling the truth and they were being honest about it, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But as WWE tends to do with just about everything else, they love to shove it down your throat. And again, people have criticized me for being a hypocrite. Well, you promote your Twitter and Facebook. Yes, dummies, but I do it at the end of my show. I don't do it every 5 seconds. It's gotten to the point where literally trending on Twitter is more important than winning a match or winning a championship. That much became obvious. I think it was on the Slammy show. But it was one of the Raw shows in recent weeks. They had, you know, it was like the trending on Twitter award, and the only way to win the match or something is I remember the exact specifics of it. It was something ridiculous that involved trending on Twitter as being the most important thing. When you get to a point where trending on Twitter is more important than winning a fucking match, your company has big, big problems. WWE has big, big problems when it comes to this stuff. They've got a credibility issue, that we already know. They lie to us all the time with those did-you-know facts. But the reality is, this trending on Twitter nonsense has got to stop. It just has to stop. Because when that becomes more important than the product itself, then what's the point? What's the point of even having a match? Why don't we just have 2 hours of Raw every week, and we'll put graphics up on the screen to show who's trending on Twitter? And that'll be the show. I give you trending on Twitter, ladies and gentlemen, one of the absolute worst things to happen to WWE in 2011. Number five on the list, Zack Ryder and the Z True Long Island Story. Zack Ryder's YouTube show, his first episode was posted on February 17th, and it was a way for him to express himself and to get his name out there, because WWE was not doing anything with him. And Zack Ryder certainly wasn't on my radar. I mean, I knew of him, but I didn't really know much about him. I didn't care for him very much. I think he was the guy who used to come out wearing tights that had one pant leg and one missing. He was trying to be different and trying to get noticed. And this, as he has since explained, was his way of trying to get noticed, and either he was going to get fired or he was going to get noticed and pushed by the company. And thankfully for him, there were people who supported him, John Cena being one of them, and spoke highly of him and his efforts to get himself noticed and really take, you know, he took a proactive approach. You know, instead of just bitching about the fact that he wasn't getting pushed and just not doing anything about it, he chose to do something about it. And in the end, it worked out pretty well for the guy, I'd say. He ended 2011 as one of WWE's most popular stars. He's actually one of their hottest merchandise sellers now. He's the United States champion. You know, and he's about to celebrate 50 episodes, I believe, in the next couple of weeks of his show, which is pretty impressive. How much longer he'll continue to do the show for, I don't know. It would be in his best interest to keep it going, because for him to stop now would be kind of foolish, and it would almost be like he's turning his back on the fans in a way. But that little internet show, that little YouTube show, created one of WWE's most unlikeliest stars of 2011. It's really quite an interesting story to look back on. It's actually really, really cool stuff. And other people have tried to copy him, of course. I think Kurt Hawkins had a brief, I think, internet show. I don't even think it went beyond one or two episodes. Tyler Rex just started some sort of animated show recently that also now is over. In fact, I think he removed all the existing episodes because he had gotten into some trouble for it. You're going to have that with people. You know, obviously they see, hey, it worked for Zack Ryder, why can't it work for me? Really, you can only do that one time, I think. And Zack Ryder did it. He was very creative with the way, you know, when he wasn't being pushed, he can't really do that now since he is being pushed. He's got the U.S. title. But when he was not getting pushed and he was first trying to get noticed, he would have these funny little things on his show where it would show him trying to, like, climb over a fence. And he was having trouble climbing over the fence, and he would look in the camera and say, I'm trying to get over, bro. You know, stuff like that. Or he would show a Zack Ryder, you know, action figure being pushed. And he's, you know, he's like, WWE should try pushing Zack Ryder. Just funny, creative little things like that. And he got over. He got over on his own. That's not an easy thing to do. And it's also not something WWE typically rewards. Typically, they frown upon that. Because if they don't create you, if they don't make you a star, then if you go out and become a star on your own, somehow they resent you for it. Which is, of course, a completely preposterous point of view, but that's WWE for you. But in this case, Zack Ryder is a bona fide success story. He may not be a world champion one day. Maybe he will be. I don't know. Not with this gimmick, I don't think. But he's come pretty damn far since that first episode got posted on February the 17th. And it's actually a really cool thing to watch. And I'm a Zack Ryder supporter just because, you know, I respect what the guy was able to accomplish. I was sitting in Madison Square Garden at the Survivor Series when people were going nuts for this guy. You would think he was the second coming of Hulk Hogan or Bruno in the Garden. It was unbelievable. The Rock is trying to cut a promo in Madison Square Garden after his first match in 7 years, and the people are chanting, "We want Ryder." Who would have expected that back in February? Nobody. Not one person. Not even Zack Ryder could have predicted that would happen. But it did. And I think we've all been part of something special in that regard. It's really cool to see a young guy like that climb the ranks so quickly. And now the ball is in his court. You know, how much further he can go, I think, is going to be, it's going to be entirely up to him. It's his destiny at this point. But it's definitely been a very fun ride to see Zack Ryder's evolution over the course of 2011. Number four on the list, Edge retiring as the World Heavyweight Champion. This was a huge blow to WWE and the SmackDown brand in particular. Edge had become one of the top stars in the company over the last couple of years. And in fact, in just the last, I think, 5 years, he won a total of 11 world championships, which is amazing, but in other ways, it's also kind of depressing. But Edge definitely was one of the biggest stars in the company and could still have some really good matches when he wanted to go. But he was just very, very beaten up. I mean, he had suffered a lot of injuries and muscle tears and had neck problems and all sorts of issues over the last several years. And the neck problems caught up with him. He was the World Heavyweight Champion. He was starting to feel some, I think, tingling in his extremities and his fingers, and clearly he was having issues, and he went in to have an MRI done. He went to WrestleMania. He beat Alberto Del Rio to retain the championship, and I think the day after WrestleMania might have been when he got the diagnosis of spinal stenosis. and that he was not going to be able to compete anymore. His career was effectively over. Spinal stenosis is a narrowing of the spinal column, and he was running a very, very serious risk by competing. And WWE was not going to take that risk, you know, looking at him as a liability. They said, we're not even going to clear you to wrestle. Your career is over. That's it. There's no, you know, let me sit out for a year and come back. This is the end of the road. And Edge had been contemplating retirement already. You know, he had actually said that if WrestleMania was coming to Canada, if WrestleMania was coming to Toronto this upcoming year instead of Miami, where it ended up going, he viewed that as his potential retirement. So Edge was closer to the end of his career at this point than the beginning of it. But the way everything went down, it was still a huge surprise. I mean, nobody saw it coming. When Edge came out on Raw to cut that heartfelt promo, which was not scripted, they let him go out there and just announce what had happened. I, like a lot of people, figured it was probably part of an angle, because that's how we've been conditioned to think. You know, when a guy goes out there and pours his heart out, if it's happening on TV, it must be an angle. And if he's saying he's going to retire, then obviously it's a way for, you know, Alberto Del Rio, who he was feuding with at the time, to get some heat on him. And perhaps, you know, that's some sort of angle they're playing so that Del Rio in the rematch will win the championship, which he never did. But in fact, it was all a shoot. They let Adam Copeland go out there, not as Edge, but as Adam Copeland, and cut a promo and let people know that, you know, his career is over. And he was retiring as champion, which is also something unique that you don't see very often. A guy, you could say that Edge went out on top. He didn't go out on his own terms. I'm sure if you would have given him the choice, he would not have gone out that way. He probably, like a lot of old school guys, would have loved to have gone out putting somebody else over. That's kind of how, you know, The Rock did it and Steve Austin did it. But, you know, it was just a horrible way in some ways for his career to end. But when you look at it like that, he went out victorious at WrestleMania as the World Heavyweight Champion, as one of the big, really the biggest star of the SmackDown brand. I could think of worse ways for one's career to come to an end. And hopefully it's not too late for those physical issues to hopefully be kept at bay. And if he does stay out of the ring, as he should, not have a negative effect on his quality of life going forward. He's still a relatively young guy. He's, I believe, in his, probably by now, his late 30s, I would guess. Probably closing in on 40. And it was a huge blow. WWE, it was really something that illustrated their lack of ability to create new stars, new main event stars over the last couple of years. By losing Edge, it created an opening for his friend Christian to be slotted in there. And he had a run as the champion that was very brief. But again, it wasn't as though Christian became the number one guy on SmackDown. Christian became a joke in some ways, even after all those great matches he had with Randy Orton. But, you know, 2011 will go down as the year that Edge was forced to retire. Kind of a sad time if you're an Edge fan, a sad time if you're a WWE fan, because Edge went out there and had some great matches, and he was one of the top guys, and just like that, in the blink of an eye, your career could come to an end. And in a lot of ways, that was one of the most sobering stories of 2011. Number three on the list was the return of The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, back in the good graces of WWE, coming back to make an appearance as the guest host of WrestleMania 27 and to kick off his feud with John Cena. And a year in advance, they shake hands to make official the WrestleMania main event for 12 months later, which is now coming up rapidly in Miami. It'll be Cena versus The Rock. A dream match to some. I know other people don't necessarily see it that way, but in reality, it's one of the biggest matches that WWE could do at this point. You're not going to get Hogan Austin anymore, so Rock vs. Cena is about as good as it's going to get. And Rock also made his in-ring return in 2011. The first match in over 7 years that The Rock has wrestled. He made his comeback at Madison Square Garden in November at the Survivor Series, teaming with John Cena to defeat Miz and R-Truth. I was there that night, and when I got my ticket for the Survivor Series, I had no idea that I was going to be there to witness The Rock's first match back. That was not being promoted at the time that we at SC Scoops had gotten our tickets. So that was kind of an added bonus. It was a really cool thing to be a part of. The place went crazy, of course, and Cena got booed out of the building. You know, to be there live as a fan, it was a really fun experience. But the thing about The Rock coming back is the impact that it has had on business. Now, if you look at the buy rate for Survivor Series, you would think it had absolutely no impact. The Survivor Series buy rate was a huge disappointment. And yeah, you can blame The Rock for part of that if you want to, but to do so, to lay all of the blame on The Rock, and for the people who don't like the guy to be like, aha, you see, this is proof that this guy doesn't mean what he used to mean, would be naive, because all you need to do is look back at the beginning of the year. When The Rock first came back, The Rock showed up on Raw for the first time on Valentine's Day, okay, February 14th. And from the moment that The Rock showed up, business picked up noticeably. Every Raw show, from that 2/21/11 show to April 3rd, okay, from the 21st of February, the week after he came back, straight through until WrestleMania, every Raw show sold out. That has not happened in years and years and years, probably going back to the Attitude Era. And WrestleMania broke 1 million worldwide pay-per-view buys, largely because of his presence on the show, and he didn't even have a match. He didn't even wrestle. He was being promoted as a guest host. Now, yes, they were teasing some animosity with him and John Cena. You knew there was going to be some sort of physicality between the two of them. And that's what people wanted to see. They wanted to see The Rock beat the hell out of John Cena, which is kind of what happened. You know, he did give him the Rock Bottom at the end of the show and cost him the championship in one of the more anticlimactic finishes to a WrestleMania show ever. But you cannot discount the impact that The Rock's return had on business. And that great business that WWE did with all those sold-out Raw shows and with WrestleMania doing over 1 million buys worldwide helped carry them for the rest of the year. You know, some of their numbers in their earnings reports were not so impressive. Imagine how much worse that would have been if you did not have The Rock's comeback earlier this year to bank on. You know, it's actually quite scary how bad things truly would have been without him around. And that's the only, you know, it's the sort of thing you can only bank on one time. You don't have too many guys like The Rock that disappear for 7 years and then come back. Steve Austin would be the only other guy. And I think in 2013 there may be a chance you can lure him back in. But do not discount the impact that The Rock's return had on business, at least in the early part of this year, and how it helped carry the company for the rest of the year, even as disappointing as that Survivor Series number, and it really was. It really was a bad number. But I don't blame The Rock or John Cena for that so much as I blame WWE themselves for booking that match to be a complete fucking joke. First of all, people did not want to see Rock and Cena as tag team partners, just like they didn't want to see them shake hands on Raw to make the WrestleMania match. You know, people didn't want to see that. And also, the way they booked Miz and R-Truth did not do them any favors either. I cannot think of a more inept-looking tag team to book John Cena and The Rock against than The Miz and R-Truth, who got beaten single-handedly by John Cena, who then got a fluke tag team pin on John Cena that Cena then bounced up from and seemed to laugh at and didn't even care about. I mean, it was a complete joke. And we're supposed to believe that The Rock has put aside his animosity towards Cena because Miz and R-Truth pose such a grave threat to the WWE? Really? Grave threat? Did I miss something here? So the way they promoted that match was just fucking terrible. As a fan in the building that night, nobody gave a shit about Miz and R-Truth. We just wanted to see, you know, what was going to happen between Cena and The Rock. I mean, that's really what it boiled down to. And they paid the price for that, because I think you could have built that match up as something special. You could have put the two of them in an elimination match. You know, a traditional Survivor Series match. But, you know, what's done is done. All roads now lead to WrestleMania. What are they going to do with Rock and Cena going forward? What are they going to do with them in that time period between Royal Rumble and WrestleMania? And that may tell the tale of business for WWE in 2012. You know, we may be sitting here a year from now talking about the impact that Rock vs. Cena had on their business in 2012 because the rest of the year sucked. I hope not. I hope business picks up next year. I hope they can, you know, find that diamond in the rough or pull their head out of their ass and actually, you know, give the fans what they want to see. But that remains to be seen. But in 2011, The Rock had more of an impact on this company than any other single person, except Vince McMahon. At the end of the day, Vince McMahon's impact on the business is what either is going to make it succeed or keep it from succeeding. But behind him, The Rock had a huge impact, and that cannot be discounted. Number two on the list, CM Punk. WWE has had trouble creating new main event stars now for a long time. You can even argue, I mentioned Edge a moment ago, Edge may have been the last true guy to get over as a main eventer in WWE back in 2006. That's a pretty big drought right there. CM Punk came along. He's been in the company now for a couple of years. And he's always had people behind the scenes that don't like him. You're always going to have people playing politics. They don't like you. They talk bad about you in production meetings and whatnot. And CM Punk had this stigma as this independent guy with tattoos and piercings who thinks his shit doesn't stink. And that's always going to rub people the wrong way, you know. And Punk, you know, you look at Punk, you listen to him in interviews and stuff, and I've never met him personally, but he comes off as a little smug. And you can see where that might rub people the wrong way. And Punk had some success. You know, he became a World Heavyweight Champion. He had that feud with Jeff Hardy. Looking back on that, was actually a great feud. And all that. But then Punk kind of hit a wall. And he was pushed down the card a bit. He had his head shaved by Rey Mysterio. And then he had this feud with The Big Show, which just screamed mid-card feud. And he had a mask on. And he was leading the Straight Edge Society. And they really weren't pushed as anything special. And Punk got hurt. He did the commentary thing for a while, and he was great at that. And they put him with the new Nexus at the beginning of the year. So you figure, okay, well, CM Punk is going to have a feud with John Cena, the company's biggest star, on Raw, and not SmackDown anymore. And he's leading a new faction. Well, the new Nexus may go down as one of the absolute worst factions in the history of wrestling. And Punk's feud with John Cena was over in a flash. It was almost aborted too quickly so they can move Punk to a feud with Randy Orton, where Randy Orton beat him at WrestleMania. So Punk was going nowhere fast, and he had already made the decision in his mind that when his contract came due in the summer, he was gone. He was leaving WWE, and he was going to take a break from the wrestling business. He wasn't going to go to TNA or back to ROH. He just wanted to get out of WWE and take a break. And WWE did not want to lose him. They could not afford to lose another star. But can you really say that they were losing a main event star? Not really, because they never really gave Punk the ball to be a real main eventer. When they gave it to him, they yanked it right back out of his hands. So, fast forward to the summer, Punk's contract is coming due. This leaks on the internet. Everyone figures this guy's on his way out. And then comes June 27th. And that was the night that John Cena had the tables match with R-Truth, and CM Punk was being built up as Cena's next challenger before he left the company. And Punk sits Indian style on the stage after the match is over. Cena's in a heap, laying in the ring after being put through a table. And then CM Punk just sat there on stage with a microphone in his hand and changed the entire course of WWE in 2011 with one promo. One promo is what started the whole thing. It was Punk's coming out party back on June 27th. It was his Austin 316 King of the Ring moment. You know, it helped solidify him as a true main event player in WWE. He went to Money in the Bank. He had the best match of the year at Money in the Bank. Won the championship from John Cena. They did the angle with him that they just rushed through way too quickly. He headlined SummerSlam. He headlined a pay-per-view, even though he lost, to Triple H. Headlined another pay-per-view after that. Won the championship from Del Rio in Madison Square Garden, which was a big deal to him, at Survivor Series. And just headlined another pay-per-view that John Cena didn't even have a match on. And had a damn good main event against The Miz and Alberto Del Rio. Punk has officially become a main event player in WWE. There's no argument, there's no debate. You know, are they going to push him back down as a mid-card player? No, he is in the main event. And it's very, very rare that you will find that WWE really makes somebody a main event guy. Punk is that guy. And again, it's an amazing transformation from how he used to be treated to where he is today. He is one of the biggest stars in the entire company. He's right on that same level now with John Cena and Randy Orton, if not even a little bit higher than Orton on the list. So Punk's 2011, his year last year, was the biggest year of his entire professional career. Where he goes from here, is it on to a feud with Chris Jericho? We'll find out. You know, he won't be in the final match on the show. He should have a headline match in WrestleMania, which is where he belongs, because Punk is a great wrestler. He's a great promo guy. He's a great wrestler. He's a character. He can do face. He can do heel. I still think Punk is much better as a heel. And let him be babyface for the next year. And if you want to really get Steve Austin out of retirement, turn Punk heel at the end of 2012 and allow him and Steve Austin to do their thing at WrestleMania next year. And I think you'll have magic on your hands. But Punk still hasn't gotten those ice cream bars that he's been barking about. But 2011 for him, I'd call that a pretty good year. And number one here on the list, my top 25 most memorable things from WWE in 2011. And I hate to end on a sour note. The commentary of Michael Cole. I want to read you a little something here. I actually got this email earlier this morning from one of our listeners. Chris from Salford, England wrote in. And this is what he said, part of his email here. He says, I was watching SmackDown this week and I lost it when Booker T corrected Cole after Cole called an inside cradle a roll-up. And Michael Cole's response was, quote, whatever, what's it matter? We are storytellers out here. What do I look like, Jim Ross or Gordon Solie? Another thing Chris mentions here on the same show was when Heath Slater came out later in the show and Cole said, oh no, not this guy. I'm not a Slater fan, but he needs as much help as he can get. He was dismissed by Cole before he even started. Slater is a heel, though, so what is the point of this? He's burying heels and faces now? This email, and I haven't seen all of SmackDown yet. I saw the main event, and that's about it. This email infuriated me, but this was almost like the greatest email that I could get, because I've had Cole at the top of my top 25 list all week, and this right here provides me with great ammunition. That right there is a perfect example of why the commentary of Michael Cole vis-a-vis Vince McMahon, because let's be honest here, much of what you hear come out of Cole's mouth is the brainchild, or the real thoughts, quite frankly, of Vince McMahon. It's a character that Michael Cole is portraying on television, because Cole has been with the company since 1997, and we've never, ever seen this side of him before. It's not like Michael Cole has finally been told, all right, go out there and just speak your mind and shoot, and this is how he really feels. Michael Cole is a smart enough person in real life to know the kind of damage that he is doing to the product. But Vince McMahon doesn't seem to care. He is doing real damage to his own company. This right here, this email that Chris sent me, is proof positive of that. I mean, it's one thing to not have your announcers call moves. Joey Styles complained about that years ago when he was briefly an announcer on Raw. Vince McMahon would pull him aside and say, listen, what are you calling holds out there for? That's old school. We don't do that anymore. We tell stories. That's fine. They've been telling stories for years. This is nothing new. But to have Michael Cole actually say that on television is completely ridiculous. And then when you have a guy like Heath Slater come out, I could give two shits about Heath Slater. That's how well they built this guy up to me. I mean, I was never a fan of his one-man rock band gimmick. I think it's really corny and really stupid. But Chris is right. Heath Slater is a guy who needs all the help he can get because he's not over a lick. So either cut the guy or try to give him a push. But instead they have Michael Cole. Now here's the thing. For the people who say, well, Cole's a heel, that's what he's supposed to do. Bullshit! First of all, who's ever heard of a heel play-by-play announcer? And yes, I know they don't do play-by-play anymore. I call him play-by-play because you have a play-by-play guy and you have a color guy, okay? Michael Cole fills the role of play-by-play storyteller. How about that, okay? He is the main storyteller. He is the guy that is supposed to convey all these different things to us and try to convince us to pay money on the go-home shows to see these pay-per-views. Is there any wonder why pay-per-view business for WWE has never, ever been as bad as it was in 2011? Fewer and fewer and fewer people are buying these shows. Is it just Michael Cole's fault? No, but that's a very big part of it. I don't believe a goddamn word that comes out of that guy's mouth. He has zero credibility with me. He's annoying. I don't like him. And it's not this type of heat that, oh, I want to see Michael Cole get his butt kicked. Been there, done that. They already put Michael Cole in the ring. And guess what? He actually got a win over Jerry Lawler at WrestleMania. There was never a real payoff to that because Cole is back on television doing the same shtick that he was doing at the beginning of the year. He never got his comeuppance. He never got kicked off the show so that Jim Ross or somebody else can come back and take his place. Even Josh Matthews at this point would be an upgrade. It never came. It never happened. Yes, Michael Cole had to kiss Jerry Lawler's foot on pay-per-view in May. Whoop-de-fucking-do. A lot good that did, because Cole is doing the same thing he was doing at the beginning of the year. There is no end in sight to this character. And if you can prove to me the benefit of having a character like Michael Cole on television, prove to me what good it does your product by having him go out there and rip everything to shreds. I will give you $1 million. And I'm pretty content that $1 million I don't have, by the way, is staying with me. Because you cannot give me one good reason why this continues to happen. People write into me, they post on Facebook and Twitter. They've stopped watching the shows. They've stopped watching the product altogether because they cannot stand the commentary of Michael Cole. It's one thing to say, well, just mute the show. You can't mute the show every week. You can't do that. People are just stopping their watching habits. They're not watching Raw every week anymore. They're not watching SmackDown because of Michael Cole. He is so horrendous, so horrendously annoying and obnoxious and counterproductive to everything that they're trying to do. It is literally turning viewers away in droves. Chris uses Heath Slater as an example here, and that's a great example to use. I'll give you one better. Daniel Bryan, another one of the original members of the Nexus. Daniel Bryan is a guy that needs all the help he can get as well. He might have been a big fish in a small pond in Ring of Honor and had a lot of respect and was revered as one of the greatest wrestlers on the independent circuit. When he came to WWE, all that shit went right out the window. He's a small guy who lacks personality, which is complete fucking bullshit, by the way, because anybody who's followed the career of Bryan Danielson or watched him, for example, in Colt Cabana's movie, okay, the documentary that he did, knows that Bryan Danielson is actually a pretty charismatic guy when you let him be. But on television, they portray him as this nerd. He's vegan, and he doesn't own a television set. That's all you ever hear from Michael Cole when he comes out. And at the beginning, that's fine. You know, back in the NXT days, that was acceptable because Michael Cole singling him out was actually giving Daniel Bryan a platform that none of the other guys on NXT had. It was a nice little angle, and you figured, okay, well, this is a way to get Daniel Bryan over, and eventually he'll get on TV, and this will stop. This will come to an end. Michael Cole will either get his comeuppance in some way and just stop talking shit about Daniel Bryan, or he'll admit, you know what, this Daniel Bryan guy's not too bad. But that never happened. It just continued, and it continues to this day. Daniel Bryan is now the world heavyweight champion in spite of their attempts to bury him via Michael Cole's commentary. He is the world heavyweight champion now. He is the representative of SmackDown. It's number one guy, in theory. And you still let your lead announcer go out there and bury him every fucking week, week in and week out, and call him a nerd, and call him a goof, and this and that. He doesn't deserve it. He had a cheat to win. Look, the way they put Daniel Bryan over at TLC to win the championship was not the way that I would have put Daniel Bryan over. He basically did just lay on top of Big Show and take advantage of a beaten man. He didn't really do anything overly impressive to win the championship. But it is what it is. Now it's your job to do everything in your power to try to get him over as something special. But no, they have Michael Cole out there every week drawing attention to the fact that this guy didn't do anything. He doesn't deserve to be the champion. He doesn't deserve to be the champion. Then why put the fucking belt on him in the first place? And around we go. And that's just another example. I can give you five more if you gave me some time. Every single week with this. And it's not a matter of Michael Cole being a heel. First of all, again, it's completely ridiculous for him to be the heel in this role. But he's not just making fun of baby faces. He's making fun of heels as well. So where does it end? What is the point of all this? It's a year now. A year that we put up with this commentary from Michael Cole, and I sit here asking the same question. What is the fucking point? Because I got two functioning eyeballs here and ears that'll bleed every time Michael Cole comes on my television set, and I still can't figure out what the point of any of this is. I can't see what the end game here is. You know, at first I thought, okay, they're going to WrestleMania. Cole and Lawler. And Lawler will shut him up and that'll be the end of it. Nope. Didn't work out that way. Then I figured, well, Maybe Cole is the anonymous Raw general manager after all. And that's going to be the payoff here. He's going to be the GM. And I think Michael Cole as the GM or a manager would be a far more effective character on television. Nope! We never even got a resolution to the anonymous Raw general manager storyline. Michael Cole continues to poison these television shows every single week. And Vince McMahon either realizes it and doesn't give a fuck, or he's too stupid to realize the damage, the long-term damage that he is doing to his product. So here we are now in 2012. It's a brand new year. Same shit, different year. Michael Cole is going to continue doing everything that he does every single week. He's going to continue to turn more people off of these television shows and do more damage to this product than any other single person in the last 10 years. And that, unfortunately, is the real lasting story of 2011 into 2012. There's a lot of positive things to speak of, a lot of positive things I've outlined here on this list. The number one thing is the commentary of Michael Cole and the way that it has infected everything on their television shows. Not just Raw, as if that isn't bad enough, but SmackDown too, because he's a commentator on both shows. The Michael Cole character is a cancer on this product. And instead of undergoing treatment to help cut the cancer out, WWE has elected to forego treatment and allow it to spread. Why? Maybe they have a death wish. I don't know. I do know one thing, though. 2012, they better get their shit together and put an end to this. Because if they don't, they're going to end up driving everybody away from this product. And they're going to reach a point where I don't know that they could come back from. If we're not there already, we're pretty damn close. You better get your head out of your ass and do something about this, because people aren't going to stand for this much longer. Now, for the people who have asked, what are my favorite matches of the year? My three favorite WWE matches of 2011, in order from my favorite to, I guess, third favorite. Number one, John Cena and CM Punk at Money in the Bank. It had the feel of a WrestleMania main event, even more so than this year's WrestleMania main event had. There was no better match from start to finish, with crowd reaction, the match itself, the length, the drama, the storyline, all of it, than Cena vs. Punk in 2011. Number two on the list, Triple H and Undertaker at WrestleMania 27. An amazing match, considering both men hadn't really wrestled in many, many months. Triple H in almost a year, in fact. And they pulled off an amazing match at WrestleMania last year. And number three, hard to pick just one Randy Orton versus Christian match, but I'm going to go with SummerSlam. They had their no disqualification match at SummerSlam for the World Heavyweight Championship. I believe that was when Orton won the title back from Christian. They had a lot of great matches last year, but many of them were the same after a while. They kind of like all blend in together. This match was set apart from those with all the garbage and the plunder and all that, which I'm not always a fan of, but somehow in this match they made it work. And that finish, the RKO on the ring steps, was one of the all-time great finishes of last year. And just an amazing match. So that's my top three favorite matches of WWE for 2011. Now, let's just move on briefly here to TNA and ROH. I'm not doing a top 25 for each of them, but just a couple of thoughts on TNA for 2011 here. Again, in no particular order, but Victory Road comes to mind. The Victory Road pay-per-view in March was the show that had the Sting-Jeff Hardy main event. Jeff Hardy showed up in no condition to compete for whatever reason. Maybe because they're all brain dead, they let him go out there anyway. And it was one of the absolute worst abortions of a pay-per-view main event you'll ever see on a wrestling show. And Sting was forced to literally hold Jeff Hardy down physically for the pin in about 2 minutes. And it was an absolute outrage. And TNA's official response to this was to give angry fans who ordered the show a 6-month subscription to their TNA On Demand service. Now, they didn't have to do anything, that's true, but still, a slap in the face to their fans if I've ever seen them, just by even allowing that match to happen. You know, it took a while for the company to wipe the stain of what happened to Victory Road out of their mouths, but definitely one of the lowlights for their company in 2011. One of the highlights, whether they want to admit it or not, was Vince Russo stepping down as the head writer, allowing Bruce Prichard to take over as the lead of the creative department. Now, Vince Russo, unfortunately, is still employed by TNA. He is still writing for the shows. And judging by some of the recent Impact reports that I've read online, I'm not so sure now that Vince Russo's influence is not seeping back into the product, but anybody else other than Russo in charge of creative giving a new vision is going to be a positive. I'm not even saying that long term the company is going to be so much better off. Maybe Bruce Prichard sucks in that role. I still think it's too early to tell. But they've had Russo in that spot for so long, and he's so fucking terrible that I can't see how putting somebody, anybody else in that spot can be construed as anything but a positive. And it's a move I never even thought TNA would make. I shouldn't even give TNA that much credit for it, because it wasn't like they demoted Russo. This was Russo's decision. And it was in the works for many months. It was not a sudden thing where they just went to him and said, listen, you know, you're out and Bruce Prichard is in. But still, it was a move that had to be made. Hopefully long-term it'll have great benefits for the TNA product. But this, to me, was one of the best things I heard about TNA at all in 2011. Another positive was also the ascension of James Storm and Bobby Roode to main event level in TNA. Both men ended the year as a world champion, which, again, if you are a fan of old school wrestling and the way things used to be done and how, you know, championships, what they used to mean, this probably just makes you shake your head. You know, the fact that both guys became main eventers at the end of the year, and they're already either a current world champion, former world champion. You know, James Storm had a very brief reign. Unfortunately, winning the title for the first time doesn't mean what it used to. Money in the Bank has kind of sullied that a little bit. Actually, it's sullied that a lot, quite frankly. Winning the title for the first time used to mean something. You know, look at the way they built it up for Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12. It's supposed to be the culmination of a dream. And, a highlighted match on pay-per-view, and you just don't see that anymore. But still, it was time for TNA to push some new faces into the main event other than Sting and Kurt Angle and Jeff Jarrett and even Jeff Hardy. Bobby Roode and James Storm were two guys that were TNA guys through and through, had a lot of success as a tag team for many, many years in TNA, and all their hard work culminated now in them being thrust into the main event. And I say it's about time. You know, Bobby Roode has went heel. He's been the world champion now for a while, is doing well enough for himself. James Storm got over big time as well. Hopefully all roads lead to the two of them reuniting in a one-on-one feud at the beginning of the year. They could feud over the championship, and it's refreshing. It's refreshing to have two guys, former tag team wrestlers who suddenly are main event players fighting for the championship. I could think of two other guys who are known as tag team guys who got thrust into fighting for the world championship, and they turned out pretty well, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. So I say thumbs up to TNA on giving the green light to James Storm and Bobby Roode. I also give TNA the green light on something else here on this list, and that is the push of Austin Aries. Austin Aries, who at one point was part of the TNA roster as Austin Starr, made his comeback to the company at a time when I think he was at a crossroads in his career. He was not sure if he was still going to continue in professional wrestling or not. Austin Aries had, of course, for those of you who don't know, Austin Aries was a former Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion, and he actually auditioned for the most recent season of WWE Tough Enough, and he had made the cut. He was going to be on the show. USA Network and Shed Media, the company that produced the show, they had picked him. And when Kevin Dunn and WWE looked at the list and they realized they had picked Austin Aries and a couple of these other indie guys, they basically put the kibosh on it and said, no, we don't want these guys on the show. We want people that have personalities and that people that look a certain way. And obviously one of the knocks on him is that he's a short guy. And he got cut. He never did make the final cut of the show. And he was very down on that whole experience. And then TNA swooped in and they signed him. And he's turned into one of TNA's brightest stars, you know, reigning X Division champion. And again, had a first run with TNA that was not so successful. And now he seems to have turned the corner, and he's one of the more entertaining aspects. You know, whenever I see an Austin Aries promo on TNA TV, and if I don't see his matches, if I read a report about, you know, how the match was, he consistently is doing good work and is one of the more, talked about performers on the TNA roster. I don't know that he'll ever make it to a world heavyweight champion level. It's certainly possible. He did very well for himself in ROH. I never fancied myself a huge Austin Aries fan, but I respected his work. And it's nice to see somebody who can actually work getting some positive TV time on TNA television. Matt Hardy. Unfortunately, I have to mention this. And I haven't mentioned his name on this podcast very often in recent months because I just got to a point where I just... I didn't want to give him the time of day. I still don't want to, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention his name here. TNA swept in and signed him to a contract at the beginning of the year, and Matt Hardy made his debut in January at the Genesis pay-per-view. And by August, he was gone, to no one's surprise. If anything, I'm surprised it took that long. He got himself into a lot of trouble. He had a couple of DWIs or DUI arrests, and it takes a lot for Dixie Carter to fire somebody as loyal as she is. I mean, for God's sake, look how many years that Vince Russo has been employed there. It takes a lot for her to get rid of somebody, but she got rid of Matt Hardy. What does that say about Matt Hardy? I'll let you be the judge. And the last thing on the list here, I got to mention this, is China. Joni Lauer made her return to the wrestling ring, and she did it with TNA. And she actually did a tag team match. I think it was her and Kurt Angle, I believe it was, against Jeff Jarrett and Karen Angle. It was a one-and-done type of thing. She did the match, and she wasn't awful in it, although I think she almost killed Jeff Jarrett on a body slam, if I remember correctly. But that was it. She wanted to work with TNA more. They didn't want to work with her. Why they brought her in the first place, I don't know. Did they really expect to pop a big pay-per-view number with her? TNA popping a big pay-per-view number, that's high comedy right there. They never should have brought her in the first place. And yes, for those of you asking, China is the one who I was referring to on that show when I said that she was something that you would kill in a video game to advance to the next level. So at least I got that one good line off on her, the one positive of her being brought back to television this year. Ring of Honor also had a very important year. The biggest story, I guess, for Ring of Honor, of course, was the company being sold to the Sinclair Broadcast Group. Ring of Honor was knocked off television at the beginning of the year from HDNet. The final episode of their HDNet show aired in April, and they were left without television, which, of course, can be a killer more often than not to a wrestling company. Once you get on TV, to then lose TV and no longer be on, not a good thing. And Cary Silkin sold 100%, I believe, of his equity in the company to Sinclair Broadcast Group, and therefore Sinclair, owning various affiliates, TV stations across the country, decided to put Ring of Honor on television. They bought Ring of Honor. They wanted to produce a new television show. Ring of Honor now finds itself, as of September, back on TV. Numbers are being kept close to the vest. I've seen reports where the show is reportedly doing anywhere between an 0.8 to as high as a 1.4 each week. I find that to be just amazing because, you know, if anything, Ring of Honor, I mean, you have a television show that has amateur-looking production values, okay? They really got to, over time, they really need to upgrade those production values. And Ring of Honor, their television show, is probably the easiest show in the world to follow. I, unfortunately, have not had time or a chance to watch the show over the last 4 or 5 weeks. But I was watching it from the beginning, and it's just such an easy one-hour wrestling show to follow. Simple storylines, character development, promos. And for a television show like that to be beating TNA on some weeks doesn't speak very well of TNA's ability to get their own talent over. So, you know, how is the show doing otherwise? Again, you don't hear a lot of news aside from those reported ratings numbers. They have to get more clearances across the country. It's ridiculous that I live in New York, which is one of their bases, and I can't even get the show on TV. I've got to go on the internet to watch the show. That is completely ridiculous. It's unacceptable. The television show should be on, at least in your major cities. So in 2012, one of the keys, I think, for the success of ROH in that television show is going to be getting more clearances so the show can actually air on TV, and people won't have to go on the Ring of Honor website to watch it. Another thing also was the Kevin Steen angle. I have to mention this. Mr. Wrestling, Kevin Steen. If you've never seen him, look up some of his matches on YouTube. He doesn't look like much. If there's one knock on Kevin Steen, it's the fact that he just looks like a fat guy. He doesn't seem to care very much about his physique. Not that he should be all jacked up to the gills, but, you know, much like Samoa Joe, who has let himself go perhaps a little bit more than he should in recent years, there comes a point where you're a pro wrestler, and you need to make sure that you look at least presentable, and that's always been the knock on Kevin Steen, but it's never really affected his work. He's a very good wrestler. I mean, that's why his name is Mr. Wrestling. And the Kevin Steen angle really kicked off a year ago. You know, Ring of Honor had their final battle show in December of 2010. It was the culmination of a feud between the heel, Kevin Steen, and the babyface, El Generico, who had been tag team partners. Now they're involved in this bitter feud. And they had just an ungodly brutal match at Final Battle that Kevin Steen lost. And as per the stipulations of that match, it was a loser leaves town match. Steen had to leave Ring of Honor. And Jim Cornette, you know, was adamant that, you know, he's gone. This is not something like a John Cena thing where you're going to be, you know, back on television or back on the show in a week. It was always intended that Steen would eventually come back, but unlike WWE or TNA, who constantly renege on their storylines, Steen was going to be out for at least many, many months, if not the better part of a year. And the Kevin Steen angle has been brewing for a while. He would cut these promos. He would try to break into the arenas to interfere with the shows. He had his first official match back at the recent Final Battle show against Steve Corino of ECW fame. And it was a match where if Steen lost, he'd have to leave the company forever. This was after being gone for a year. Obviously, Steen won. And he is now in the thick of things as far as the title picture is in Ring of Honor. And it really is amazing when you look at this whole Steen angle. Here's an angle that built for a year. An entire year plus. And now, they have a top heel in Ring of Honor heading into 2012. Clearly, they're building for a Kevin Steen Davey Richards championship match at some point. I expect them to put the title on Steen and run with it. If you look at the Kevin Steen angle, find some videos on YouTube that are floating around. It might have been from the June show that Ring of Honor had in New York City when Kevin Steen tried to interfere. He tried to buy a ticket and get into the Manhattan Center and all that. Somebody put a very good video together documenting all these different things. Watch that video. They did the CM Punk angle better than WWE did it. I mean, they really did the Punk angle from this summer better than they did it. I mean, it's not that I expected them to keep Punk off television for a year. But think about the CM Punk angle. Think about how well, how promising it was at the beginning, and how it ended up. And Punk misses all of a week from television before being brought back. It was talk about dropping the ball. But here's Ring of Honor, a much smaller promotion, an independent promotion, who actually can keep somebody out for a year. You know, I understand WWE can't necessarily do that. But they did this angle, so far, executed it to near perfection. WWE should be taking notes on how Ring of Honor does their angles. And I think, like I said, Kevin Steen now one of the top heels, if not the top heel in the promotion heading into the new year. They've now put themselves, the company has, in a position to really do some big business. You know, because they played their cards right. They actually did the angle the right way. And there's a lot to be said for that. I think Ring of Honor deserves a lot of praise for that. As we close out this year in review for 2011, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the death of Randy Macho Man Savage. The wrestling world lost one of its biggest stars in May, unfortunately, passing away not from the car accident that he was involved in, but as a result of a heart attack, which led to the accident. And it was a shame that Savage did not get enshrined into the WWE Hall of Fame before he passed away. And I say that just because there were so many fans out there of his that still supported him and loved this guy, the Macho Man. He was such a revered character, even after all these years, and he had almost been living in obscurity, almost like J.D. Salinger up in the mountains somewhere. And, you know, content with his life, and he remarried a year before he passed away. It's just a very, in a lot of ways, a very sad story, but it doesn't have to be sad, because we look back on the career of Randy Savage, and he will go down as one of the greatest of all time. And he was an intense personality who ended up in wrestling not because he was passionate about professional wrestling and always wanted to be a professional wrestler. He wanted to be a baseball player. And when that didn't work out for him, he ended up wrestling and worked for his father, of course, Angelo Poffo, who was a wrestling promoter. And from the very beginning, people took notice of this little skinny, lanky kid who would go on to become one of the most successful stars in the history of pro wrestling. You know, Savage had great matches with a ton of different guys. He had great matches with everybody. He got great matches out of Hogan. He had great matches with Flair. Ultimate Warrior. I can't think of anybody who brought Ultimate Warrior to the level that he was able to bring him when they were in the ring together. You know, even their SummerSlam match at Wembley Stadium, which doesn't get as much play as the WrestleMania match, was pretty damn good, even though that WrestleMania match was on another level, including the post-match angle. And speaking of which, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this as well. I just posted a video on Facebook, so there's your cheap Facebook plug right there. Earlier this morning, here on New Year's Day, I happened to be up very early this morning after a night of New Year's partying, and I put my WWE Classics on Demand on, which is still up. Thankfully, they haven't yanked it yet. I don't think they're pushing any new content to it, unfortunately, but it's still up, as last time I checked. And one thing that they're airing right now is an old Coliseum video called Super Tape 92. And on Super Tape 92, they have a whole bunch of random matches and segments and, you know, tax tips with Erwin R. Scheister and all that jazz. But they also have all of the matches from the Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view that WWF did in 1991. This was their first attempt at trying to do a pay-per-view during the week, you know, a weekday, like a Tuesday night. This was years and years and years before Taboo Tuesday came along and also failed. And on that show was a match between Randy Savage and Jake the Snake Roberts. This was the first match that Savage had wrestled since losing to The Warrior at WrestleMania 7. He had been coaxed out of retirement by Jake the Snake. They did the great angle with the snake bite and all that. And this was their first match. And the match itself was really nothing special. In fact, the one thing that shocked me about the match was how brief it was. The match was over within 5 minutes. And Savage pinned him clean with an elbow drop. But it was what happened after the match that really makes this a memorable angle. Because Savage was not just intent on beating Jake. He wanted to maim this man. And he attempted to bring in a steel chair, and then he attempted to bring in a ring bell, and the referee tried to pull it away from him. And in the scuffle, Jake got up and gave him a DDT. And then he gave him another one. And then he gave him a third one. And in the midst of all this, down to the ring, comes the Macho Man's wife, Elizabeth, running down to the ring, trying to cover her husband and protect him from Jake the Snake. This all led to Jake grabbing Elizabeth and slapping her across the face. So even in 1991, during the Hogan era, during the cartoon era of the WWF, which also was very much PG back then, kind of like it is now, they knew how to pull off a risque angle when they had to every now and then. And this was one of my all-time favorite angles ever, ever, ever in wrestling. And it's almost a shame how brief this feud was. This feud never had a proper ending to it. It was over within a couple of months. There was never any real blow-off. Savage just beat Jake again clean in their next match on television, and that was the end of it. But after the match on the Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view, also on this video, is the post-match backstage promo with Jake, and then with Savage. And Sean Mooney is interviewing Randy Savage. And I posted the video on Facebook. This is one of my all-time favorite wrestling promos. Savage was really over the top. He looked like he was all strung up on drugs, which he probably was at the time. But this promo is just everything about pro wrestling that I love is encapsulated in this promo. And it made me wonder, you know, what's wrong with pro wrestling these days? You watch this promo from back then. Savage just going nuts. His wife got attacked. He can't believe it. He's literally on the floor, you know, wailing away, talking about how this is over now. Jake, you're a dead man, this and that. Just great, great stuff. And not everybody back then could do a promo like Randy Savage could. He was one of the few who could pull that sort of thing off. What a great, great, great performer. And it really brought me back to a question that somebody had emailed to me in the mailbag. I look back on 2011. I did almost 60 shows, as I said. I answered probably hundreds of mailbag questions, or tried to anyway. I don't have the answers to all of them. But there was one person who wrote in, and I don't think he was being malicious at all. This would have been shortly after Randy Savage passed away, and he made the comment about how, you know, Randy Savage, to him, in his opinion, wasn't really a legend. He just doesn't see him as a legend. And the only thing I could think is, this question must have come in from somebody who was maybe 9 years old. Because unless you were, if you were even a year older than that, I just don't see how you could possibly not look at Randy Savage as being a legend. I mean, even if you don't like him as a wrestler, how do you not look at Randy Savage as a legend? That was one email that maybe out of all of them that I got all year really set me off. Because you really have to be demented in the head not to admit that Randy Savage is a legend. And this promo just screams legend. I mean, if you need any more proof as to the kind of worker Randy Savage was, go watch this promo. Don't even watch the match. Just watch the promo. And it's kind of funny that that happened to be on demand, and I happened to watch that this morning. I knew I was going to talk about Savage here. And I saw that promo, and it just brought back all these memories from my childhood of just watching Randy Savage in his prime, and what a great performer he was. And the world lost a great performer this year, way before his time. And nobody's going to forget the guy, nor should they. Hopefully he'll get his Hall of Fame treatment, if not next year, hopefully sometime in the very near future. We may never know the nature of the beef between him and Vince McMahon that kept him out of that company for so many years, but whatever it was, it's now old news, it's water under the bridge, and Savage is no longer with us, and that was the big wrestling death of 2011. You know, it wasn't some young guy overdosing on drugs or any sad sob story like that, but still, losing Randy Savage was a pretty big hit to the wrestling business, and we look back fondly on 2011 for some things. Unfortunately, for other things, we look back on the year not so fondly, and that would be one of them. So, rest in peace, Macho Man. I am sure he will get his deserved treatment in the Hall of Fame very, very soon. I want to thank everybody for writing in after last week's mailbag to mention that the gravedigger I mentioned from the old USWA was a man by the name of Bill Middleton. So the mystery has been solved. There won't be a mailbag here on the show this week because we're now 2.5 hours into the show, and I am completely spent. But the mailbag will be back on next week's show. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com if you would like to try to get your question on episode number 200. Of course, you can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster, and facebook.com/thesolemonster. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. As I sit here about to finish completion of the show, I realize that Podbean is down yet again. And I am containing my anger as I continue to search for other podcast alternatives. And I mention this only because the show is going to be going up probably on TalkShoe, our old server, for at least this week until Podbean gets back up. But the show won't pop up in iTunes until Podbean comes back because I handle all the iTunes stuff through Podbean. So subscribe to the show on iTunes. This is not going to be going on for much longer. I promise I'm going to get this fixed. But do subscribe and then also leave some feedback in iTunes if you would be so kind. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, youtube.com. You can look for The Solemonster. That's my username on there. You can subscribe. Any new videos, like the little promo I posted yesterday, any new promos or videos or anything that go up there, you can be notified of that and be the first one to see it. So, as always, I appreciate all of your support. This has been a huge show. I am completely exhausted now, but 2011 now in the books. It's a brand new year, a brand new fresh start here, and I look forward to doing another 60-plus episodes of The Sound Off in 2012. Of course, the next show, when we're back next weekend, it'll be episode number 200. Hard to believe it's been 200 episodes already, but yeah, this is about that time in the show where the Did You Know fact would pop up on the screen, letting everybody know that I've got the longest-running episodic podcast in the history of the internet, even if it is complete BS. But there's no BSing here on this show, only fact. It's ideal in fact and truth. So we'll be back next weekend. Thank you, as always, for the support. Hope you all had a happy new year. We'll see you right back here next week for episode 200 on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.